This episode of HBR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HBR15. That's HBR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Hacker Public Radio. We're back with another audiobook club, and I'm Pokey. And with me today on the audiobook club, we've got 5150.
Howdy, folks.
We got Pegwall, the legendary Peggy.
Hey, hey.
We got a pretty new member to our community and a writer and someone who's been doing lots of good work for HPR. We got Semiotic Robotic.
Hey, folks.
We got another returning favorite here. We got Taj.
What's good, everybody?
And my damn near neighbor, good buddy, X1101.
Howdy, folks.
And, you know, you'll have to forgive us. We started talking about this for probably an hour and forgot to record it. So now we get the recording going. You're going to be stunned at how natural it sounds this time.
Frankly, I think we were just all fantastic actors.
I've been pretending to be me for years.
I've been pretending to be an adult for 10 years, and nobody's figured out that I'm not. I've got a mortgage, a child, a job, and I'm like, okay.
That is some serious method acting, man.
Suckers.
Fake it until you make it.
All right, let's get this out of the way. 5150, what did you think of this book?
Well, I think you remember last time I told you that I'd tried starting it once before. And really didn't like it. Now I have to admit, I must not have given it a very good chance that first time. So I didn't get much past, Julius bringing Dan home, to the place where he lived with Lil, and I think I kind of left it off after that. So I read it again. I'm glad you made me read it. I'm not going to say it's my favorite book, but I thought it was entertaining and extremely interesting on his take of where our modern online culture is going to take us.
Pegwell, what'd you think?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was different. Like, I appreciate any story that's just kind of out there like that. When they got into the whole, like, the tribes that were not part of the bitchin' society, and they have the people that go out there and convert them, and as a result, they get all their woofy, which is the reputation-based currency, I thought it was really kind of cool to me.
Was this your first time listening to this one?
No, I listened to it again, just for this.
Cool, cool. Oh, and just as a reminder to the listeners, the show's broken up into three parts. The first segment of the show is going to be the just kind of a review of what we thought of the book without any spoilers. We'll keep the spoilers out of it. We may, discuss a couple of things that happened early in the first chapter just for like the setting and stuff. Those aren't really, wouldn't really consider those spoilers, but we won't get into the plot details too much until we have our beverage review, which comes somewhere in the middle. And then after the beverage review is all spoilers. So if you have not listened to this audiobook or read the book yet, but you enjoy the book club, hang on, listen to the beverage review, and you can pause it after that and go read the book. And we won't spoil it for you until after we review our beverages. Semiotic Robotic, what did you think? Did you listen to any of it? Did you read all of it? And what did you think of it?
I did. I did read all of it. New guy here, does not understand the concept of Hacker Public Radio audio book club, but I did enjoy reading it. I downloaded it from Corey's site, and it's my second time through. My first time through was actually 10 years ago when it first came out. It's 2004, if I'm not mistaken. So I remember reading it a long time ago when it first came out. And At first, I liked it well enough, but I didn't think it was Corey's best, and I might still maintain that opinion. But my second time through, I actually enjoyed it a lot more. I agree with the folks who said that the currency system is definitely interesting, there's just something so deliciously interesting about a guy trying to solve his own murder that I think is an instant hook.
I will agree with you. I liked this better the second time through, but I listened to it for a third time. And I flashbaked it the third time. I sped it up as much as I could tolerate and listened to the whole book a third time today. And I found so many holes in the book when I listened to the chapters closer together. I still like it, though. That's the thing. It's got so many holes in the logic and the concept, I think, now. But I still loved the book. I still thought it was a great story. But yeah, better the second time than the first. Taj?
I'll be the odd man out. I won't say I didn't like it. I did like it. It wasn't spectacular to me. I think it's got a bunch of really cool ideas. Glad Semiotic Robotics said when it was written, because that was one of the questions I wanted to know, but was too lazy to go look up, because I think the reason that I am not thrilled with this is because I've seen other people tackle the same issues and, in my opinion, do it a little better. And so I was kind of spoiled by this, although it wouldn't surprise me if this was maybe the first time that some of these things came up in prose that, people were writing about. I love Corey's other stuff. I don't know. This one's just a hit, just a miss for me.
X1101, I cut you off. What were you about to say?
Oh, I just was going to say that I look forward to hearing the holes you found, because I read the book. I actually finished the book. I had started it a while ago, read half, three quarters of it, and then finished it on the way back from NELF this spring. And then after the first book club, I was looking for something to recommend and listened to this book, another of his books, and a couple of other things. And this one's, I thought, just a better story.
You thought this was better than which other one?
Eastern Standard Tribe. I like this story's more interesting.
Yeah, I can agree with that. Eastern Standard Tribe was a slow read, but I liked that one too. It was a fun slow read.
Oh, I love Eastern Standard Tribe. I just thought this was more fun. It would have more interesting topics to discuss.
Yeah, I thought this was a little more relatable than Eastern Standard Tribe. I didn't quite see, technology playing out the way that it did in that book, but this one, it's got hooks in the way we might want reality to be, if that makes sense.
Well, I think I found Eastern Standard Tribe both too close and too far. I completely understand all the people I talk to are on that side of the country or that side of the ocean, but some of the extremes that went to in that story weren't as interesting as the issues that this story brings up.
Sure.
But now I'm reviewing a book that we didn't listen to, so.
Yeah, we kind of all are a little bit. He's a very prolific writer, and it's I've read a bunch of his books or listened to them as audiobooks, and it seems like everybody here has, so it seems like we're all familiar with Corey, so it's kind of hard to talk about any of his work without talking about all of his work, you know?
Now, am I correct that it seems to be that this was his first novel? I found lots of short stories that were older than this, but this was the first bigger story. Does that sound right to everybody? Anybody?
Yeah, that to my knowledge, it really reflected on when I read this the second time is just how much Corey has matured as a writer in the past decade. I think that his ideas are still as sharp and as interesting as they ever have been over the past decade.
You cut out. Semiotic Robotic, did we lose you? You cut out there. All right, he may have. He just dropped off. Yeah, not only was it his first novel, but it's also historically significant because it's the first novel that was ever released under a Creative Commons license, as well as being widely published.
And I know he's one of the bigger driving forces in that. I know I've listened to a plethora of his works, and at one point I've enjoyed a lot of his stuff so much I went and bought two of his books, just to say, you know, thank you for all your good work. It's been wonderful. Keep it up.
Yeah, same here. Same here. I've bought books of his as well that I never intend on reading.
Yeah, I have. I'm pretty sure I have a.
Oh, you cut out again.
Back this time?
Yeah, try it again. You think you have a what?
I said, I think I have a complete collection, if I'm not mistaken, in paperback and hardback, which I'm pretty proud of.
Oh, very cool. That's very cool.
I've only got a Dead Tree copy of one of his books, and then I've got an e-copy of another one.
I purchased the ebook version of Little Brother. And before I did, I emailed him. I was like, hey, this might seem kind of odd, like, to ask or something. I was like, if I purchase this through Google Play versus another sort of way of doing it, which one would net you the most profit? Because I dig your stuff and I want you to get the most out of my purchase.
Very cool. He probably answered, I'm guessing. What was his answer?
He said, just buy it any way you want.
That is cool. And one other thing that he does, if you download his books for free or you listen to the audiobooks and you would like to purchase his books just so that he gets some money out of it, but like me, you're never going to open the thing. He's right on his website or somewhere on his web. I'll have to look this up and put it in the show notes. You can purchase a book for a library, and there are ways for libraries and schools to request that you purchase books for them. So you can just go on there and pick out a school and purchase one of his books for them.
That reminds me of an amusing story that I think I read somewhere. I want to say that it was Little Brother and Homeland were assigned reading in a school, were then banned from the school, and then I believe he donated like 70 copies of the book to the school.
Yeah, that just happened maybe a month ago.
Yeah, I'd say about a month, yeah.
Yeah, I remember reading that, and I went and bought paperbacks of both, and I'm going to put them in my classroom.
A month ago as of the time of this recording. We're mid-July here, so by the time you're hearing this on the podcast, it's going to be much later, I think.
Yeah, good call.
I know that I've got the physical version of Homeland, and I'm definitely, when my daughter is of age that's appropriate, I'm going to suggest strongly that she read both Little Brother and Homeland.
So I also invited Corey. I didn't, like, in the past I've invited authors, like sent them an email individually, and we had one on. One said they couldn't make it, I think, and others have just ignored me in the past. This time I've gotten in the habit of putting the audiobook club on my Google Calendar and just sending the invites to people who've shown interest. So anyone listening, if you're interested, you know, just contact hpr@hackerpublicradio.com and just say that you want to be on that mailing list, and I'll add you to the mailing list that I use for the book club, and I'll add you to the Google Calendar invites. I kind of like Google Calendar because it does the time conversion for you. That's kind of handy. Everybody's on the same page that way. But I added Corey to that, and he actually responded, and he apologized that he couldn't make it. He said he would like to, but he's traveling and a lot right now, and he's in such a different time zone that it just wasn't going to work for him. But he actually did sound like he was, you know, disappointed that he couldn't make it. And I just thought it was really cool that he even bothered answering, you know, just the invite. It wasn't even a personalized email.
Well, if Ken was on the show, he would tell you, now that you've made contact, you've got a perfect opportunity to set up another one of your famous interviews.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea.
Well, he responded. I think that means he owes us a show.
Yeah, I thought that's where 50 was going with that, too.
Now, I would, if you do, I do have one question I'd like you to ask. Was I was just looking up dates, and like I said, my opening comment, I thought this book was maybe a comment on our electronic society, because the Wolfie seems, which we've talked about, this is the sort of only currency left that reflects the number of people who respect you and respect your work and what you're doing. It seemed to me like it was just making a total joke of Facebook and their likes. But I was looking, this came out a year before Facebook ever started at all. I'm not even sure when they started doing likes. So, and it might, he might have had it. I guess the question would be, did he when he wrote this, did he have the idea in his head trying to extrapolate our digital popularity? But I guess there really wasn't a measure for it back when he wrote the book, not like there is today.
Well, and here's, I guess we can talk about the Woofie and their economy without going into spoilers. And that's cool because it's one of the holes I found in the story. But so apparently they're in a post-scarcity society. Apparently there's unlimited robots with unlimited physical resources to make anything you need. And there's unlimited free energy to just provide everything you need. So therefore, currency, you know, based on some gold standard or even a fiat currency, you know, based on physical value, is really worthless. So they go with this Woofie, which is kind of like, you know, kudos or it's social currency. It's people's opinion of you at the time. And at first that seems fine. You know, it seems like it could work. But the more they go through the story, the more I have to wonder how it works. Do they, as you acquire Woofie, do you have to spend it to get the things that you need? Or does having a certain level of Woofie just entitle you to certain things? And I read a Wikipedia article that tried to explain it. I don't know where the source was for this. I didn't track down every source. But they said that basically you didn't have to have Woofie to give someone Woofie. So even if your score was zero, you could still say, oh, that guy's, you know, plus 50 Woofie. But then how do you stop like 12-year-olds from going, oh, that's a funny face, plus a billion? So I just, you know, there's so much there that it is unexplained.
Right. I do think he says at one point, there are certain almost unattainable luxury items that you actually have to spend or trade Woofie for. But I think the rest of the stuff is, you can get stuff if your Woofie is above X. It's not like they subtract it when you go to a restaurant and sit down, have your meal. But the thing is on the Woofie, you know, if your Woofie is zero, or if you have low Woofie, like or talks about early in the story, Julie is recounting his days as a student before he'd ever actually produced anything. I mean, it's completely voluntary where you want to produce, you know, spend your life doing anything, but you know, it's pretty much he was eating at the university automat or something like that. It wasn't like he could go to a really good restaurant. And it wasn't like he could really live in a house like we would think of it. He had, you know, essentially had a sleeping cubicle at the university. And then we see later in the story when your Woofie drops to zero, you know, you even have trouble getting that.
Right. That's the impression I got, is that you don't lose Woofie when you spend it, but when your reputation gets quantified at a certain point, you can access certain resources or enter certain areas, you know, of a city or whatnot, based on your Woofie score.
Yeah. And there was another hole that I found now that you mentioned that. But actually, before we do that, David Whitman joined us. David, are you able to talk with us, or are you just here to listen? Or all right, yeah, I was having trouble getting sound out of him earlier. He's on the road with Plumble, but yeah, David, if you can pipe in later, feel free to do so at any time. So anyway, yeah, if Woofie's based on your popularity, how come there were no like real celebrities? You didn't hear about like movie stars. I mean, he's a musician, but he was like a composer. You didn't hear about like pop culture at all.
I got the impression that kind of the things that they were doing, they were kind of rock stars.
Right.
Yeah, maybe a very granular form of rock star. Maybe you don't have the whole world audience like a TV show nowadays does. That's possible.
Well, I guess maybe the thought would be, if there's no point in accumulating ridiculous amounts of wealth, there's no point in trying to sell the pop culture. Therefore, the whole concept of pop culture kind of falls off, and people only make things that they really care about.
Bingo.
Also, at one point, he'd compose, like, quite a few symphonies and everything, and I think if everyone can do that and just do whatever, I don't think there's really a need for, you know, the pop culture kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I still think there's going to be sheeple.
Well, you can kind of see that when he talks about some of the people who haven't been around very long. Like, they're definitely looked down upon as, like, the people who just don't get it.
Another thing to consider, I mean, being a rock star or being a movie star, that's work. And if nobody works, then there would be no rock stars and no movie stars. He does talk about watching vids at one point. So, you know, somebody must still be making entertainment, but perhaps it's all entirely made inside the computer.
And since they're in a society where death isn't really something many people worry about, It could just be one of those things where you just do it for a while until you get bored and then go, I'm going to go do something else.
Right. I think that, you know, what you have is a situation in which with no currency in the traditional sense that we're familiar with, you also have to rethink the way you deal with social relations, right? So the idea that you have a currency that's based on what I can make for myself and gain value from, now the currency is based on what I can do for other people and what they do for me and my reputation in their eyes. So, you know, it inverts the kind of the relationship between myself and my self-interested actions and what I'm able to do for other people and how that gets quantified and how I'm able to use that as a kind of capital.
It almost parallels some discussions I've heard about the idea of the almost reputation economy in the free software and open source worlds, where you are what you can do and you are what you have given to the community.
I think that's a perfect parallel. We all know the core is deeply entrenched in that culture, and I think this is a way to extract that notion from free software and free culture into, you know, an entire social formation.
Okay. I don't disagree with anything that you guys have said there, but I don't see how any of that keeps celebrity from happening. I don't see how a movie star wouldn't make a movie for the benefit of Woofy. I mean, it clearly, if the mind has evolved, it evolves into this type of society that we're all kind of familiar with, where the best leadership are the people who don't want to lead. So the best producers of Woofy are the ones who actually don't want it. But you still can produce. You know, I mean, this guy, Jules, does everything for Woofy. Everything he does, his goal is to gain Woofy. And Dan is the same way once he's lost it. At first, clearly he isn't. But I don't know. I don't see any of that stopping celebrity and pop culture from happening.
Maybe it would be a little bit too risky to try to do that whole thing, because look how we treat, you know, like as a society, how we treat celebrities. Like, there are people that go, oh, well, that celebrity did this. And then once it's reported, it's like, you know, celebrity XYZ frowned at a puppy and then everyone's upset at them. They'd be hemorrhaging Woofy like there'd be no tomorrow.
That kind of tails into something I was going to say, is that it almost seemed like Woofy was very, very volatile, which I guess being a reputation-based economy, it would be. And that kind of points out, you know, you look at someone wrong and your reputation tanks, and then you know, pick up a bottle for somebody and skyrockets.
Yeah, I think there's two things related to Pokey's comment. The first is that motive plays a role in Woofy. So if somebody judges your motives for doing an action as unfavorable or sort of, you know, unscrupulous in some way, they can choose not to give you Woofy or detract from your Woofy. So other people are the judge and jury of sort of your own popularity. And that dovetails into the notion of pop culture, like in a way, celebrity might still exist. It doesn't preclude celebrity from happening, but what it does is it allows a sort of, populism of celebrity, right? Whereas the only people who are celebrities are not those who are manufactured to be made celebrities, but those who accumulate enough Woofy through, through popular vote almost.
Yeah, maybe it's like, limited somehow, like it, Liquid Democracy might be, or like if I like what Semiotic Robotic just said, I can give him 50 woofy, but that's all the woofy I can ever give him unless I take some of it back. That would kind of level the playing field.
Well, I think, I don't know, you said something about you didn't have to have woofy to give it, but see, they did indicate that, well, at first they valued woofy from people that they had apparently a poll or something that would, well, they could see by what woofy people given to other people, somehow mapping their likes and dislikes. So woofy from people that, I guess woofy from people generally disagreed with you was actually, valued more than woofy from people that were in lockstep agreement with you on everything.
Remind me to bring this up again after the spoilers, because there's a lot that I was thinking about this.
And see, I'll do that, Pokey. But I almost had the exact opposite impression, where if a group of people that I tend to agree with have a lot of respect for you, I will weight that more heavily than if a group of people I disagree with tend to have a lot of respect for you. That won't mean very much to me.
But it did seem to me in the book that somebody who had a lot of woofy could give more woofy than somebody who didn't have a lot of woofy. Maybe if you're at zero, you can still give. Maybe it's limited there. You can still give some, but it seems like you had to have more woofy to give to really raise somebody else's woofy.
Maybe, and that brings into question, if you lose yours, does it then take some of that other person's away? Wikipedia, again, this is not in the book, but Wikipedia based it on something, and it was in reference to Corey's writing. And the way they described it was that right-handed woofy was woofy that you got from a person for doing something directly for that person. So, like if I sent Taj a bolt of fabric to make a hammock, he could give me right-handed woofy for doing that. And people who he influences, his friends, could go, oh, that was really cool of him. And they would then give me left-handed woofy because it's not something I did specifically for them. They just thought it was cool.
Right. And related to that is the notion that you can get woofy for things that happen to you. Right. So I can't talk much about this without getting into spoilers, but there's one point in the book where,
oh, the spoiler police just shut you off, man. What happened?
The internet doesn't want spoilers.
Did you drop off again?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. What did you cut right out as soon as you started? You said and it just went dead.
Well, I said, you know, I don't want to give away too much, but you know, you can get woofy for things that occur to you, not just the things that you do. So there's a point in the book, which we'll probably talk about later in the post drink section, where Julius gets woofy for things that are happening to him. He calls it sympathy woofy.
Oh, right. Yeah, and I didn't see that as being, you know, another category. I didn't see, like, oh, there's right hand woofy, left hand woofy, and sympathy woofy. I just thought he meant, oh, it's because they're sympathetic that they're giving me that, and you know, it might be left handed woofy since it's not something he did for somebody. But again, this is all, even though I read it on Wikipedia, I still feel like it's speculation.
Yeah, it's someone is taking what they read and extrapolating it out to what they think it means.
Right.
It feels like that, yeah. But then again, the book's been out for 10 years, and Corey's so accessible, someone might have asked him about it, and, you know, because Wikipedia has to be sourced.
Corey could have written the Wikipedia article for all we know.
No, that's not allowed either. If he was, someone would have figured it out and deleted it.
Yeah, that kind of behavior is generally frowned upon.
So the other thing that this book brings up, without having to go into spoilers, is the whole backing up and restoration topic, that you can back up your life and your knowledge and your experiences, and you can be cured of anything by having your memories implanted into a cloned body. And there's definitely stuff I want to say about this after the spoilers, but I think there's plenty to say before it.
Pokey, remind me, there's some odd, like, loophole-y stuff that I also kind of picked up on there that I would like to try and remember to bring up as well.
It's probably the same stuff.
Probably.
Well, you see, I didn't realize until, in fact, Wikipedia has it wrong, that I didn't realize till later in the book when they talk about deadheading that's what they meant. They would, you know, actually take a backup, and then they would kill off your physical self and then restore you from backup after a certain number of years if you just want to tune out for a while. But the other thing they talked about it using deadheading for, because I thought when they first talked about deadheading, it was cryo refrigeration. You know, they were, you know, they just put you into a cryo chamber for that many years and then thaw you out. But the other thing they mentioned, they also use it for space travel. So if you, I guess maybe not the short in local Earth orbit like Julius, I think, talks about taking, going up to the space station. But definitely, I got the impression they had interstellar travel. And for interstellar trips, they don't transport your physical body. They, you just, you know, step into the backup receptacle and you walk out and they knock you in the back of the head and then they make a clone and restore you from backup whenever the spaceship gets to the destination, which that's one of the things I thought, you know, maybe one of the anomalies you were talking about, why would they even do that? Because it also said when they were later in the book, when they're talking about the backup system, it's not like you're backed up just on disk. You are across the network galaxy wide. So why would they, you know, why there wouldn't even be a sensation of space travel. They would just, you know, kill you here and then restore you from back up there.
And no, the other thing, they specifically talked about the body being stored in, I forget what he called them, something jars. No, he specifically talked about it and made it sound more like cryogenic stasis than a complete disembodied personality. Though your consciousness seems like it can interact on a limited basis in that disembodied state, but he specifically talked about the bodies being like, so, and even on short trips, he said he stayed awake for a 2-hour plane ride and he was like the only one, everybody else deadheaded through it.
Right. So that seems kind of drastic to let yourself be killed for a 2-hour plane ride and come out on the other end. That was the other point I was going to make. And since they did say in the book, it probably takes like a day, you know, to restore you from backup. That seems rather drastic not to sit up and stay awake for 2 hours on the plane ride.
See, I got the impression.
He does say at one point that people switch bodies just to get over a cold. So, you know, doing it to fly for 2 hours doesn't seem that bad.
Well, I got the impression with the short-term stuff like the flights and even the space travel, it was more like possibly freezing your body, but more like taking your brain and turning it off for a while and then like you would turn your cell phone off when you get on the plane and then you turn it back on again when you land.
Except yeah, exactly.
Your cell phone is your brain.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I got out of it too. Is it was more just, you know, turning the switch off on your head, but I think it's more than just that, because Dan was planning on. Well, no, I'm sorry, that's a spoiler. But some people deadhead for quite a long time, and you know their body's got to be there, I guess. But yeah, that's another part.
I can hear the announcement now on the plane. Please check off your consciousness until the pilot tells you you've reached a cruising altitude.
Yeah. So this brought up a question for me, which is, I'm not going to say I'm terribly clever in thinking about it, because I think a million people have come up with it, and I don't even think I came up with it on my own. I'm sure I've heard it before, but, you know, people, and I have an answer for the question, but I'll give you guys a shot to answer it first, I'll ask, is when someone is restored from backup, when their physical body dies and their new body you know, comes back and all your memories are implanted there, you know, people always ask, does the soul die with the body, or does it get moved into the new body with your memories? Are you the soul, or is this something more ethereal? And that's, I think the book tries to ask that question, and I think I have a pretty good answer for it, but let me hear what you guys think if you thought about it.
Well, I think it didn't seem to me like there's a lot of active religion left in the world. You're right. They did say, it is kind of mentioned, you know, is that the real you dies the first time, and but doesn't really go on, you know, not a whole lot of hand-wringing about whether it is or not. And, it, you know, this has been approached in other science fiction like it's, but at least in the books on Star Trek, you know, it's the first time somebody go on the transporter and, you know, we disassemble their molecules and reassemble. I mean, is it the original person with their soul intact, or is it a copy that comes out the other end? And, you know, in that fiction, it's never really answered either. They kind of say, well, we can do that. And, you know, it's, I guess, so important to their daily lives. I mean, it would be like saying, well, you know, to keep your soul, we've got to give up cars. You know, how many people are going to say, it would totally transform their society to give up this ability to constantly be reborn into a younger body, live forever, and not have to worry that you're going to go diving and drown underwater, which is what happened to Julius at one point.
I guess it kind of also speaks to the brain-mind dichotomy. The only analogy I've ever come up with that makes any sense, and it probably only makes sense because of what we do, is it's almost like the brain is the hardware and the mind is the software that runs on it. And then where does the soul fit into that? Is it a biological piece? Is it some metaphysical thing that we can't explain? What is it?
Well, I think, like, it's just that culture in the book has just moved past it. Because I was thinking about it, and years ago I read this, and I can't remember what it was, but it was basically the debate when heart transplants, like, became, like, thought about. Like, they weren't able to do them yet, but they were thinking about them, and the big question was, like, will this take your soul if you, like, remove your heart and replace it with another one? Which, obviously, nobody thinks about that anymore. We just do it. I mean, it's a serious procedure, but, you know, it's pretty routine and happens a lot. It's just one of those things that people are scared of things that they don't understand, but once a couple people do it and it seems to be safe, they're like, oh, okay, well, I guess it's not that big of a deal.
The question will be, if we can get to the point where we can do a brain transplant, what happens?
Yeah, so it's kind of like your grandfather's axe. You know, this is my grandfather's axe. It's had five handles and three heads, and it's just as good as the day he bought it.
Yeah. So I really like this question, Pokey, because I think that Corey missed a good opportunity here to explore this. Most of Julius's conversations with Dan about this, and they go back and forth about this all the time. It's one of the, apparently one of their like favorite debate topics that they go on and on about all the time. And that all sort of happens off screen, right? So it all happens, through narration, but you never actually hear the dialogue. And so Corey never really lets us know how the characters come down on this issue.
Well, no, I think in a way he kind of does. And they don't talk about it like a soul either, because I think X1101 is one that said that it's kind of a religious topic, and he just said the religious people just kind of died, so you know, they died off, and that makes sense in this story. They talked about it like, they said if your body's destroyed and you clone a new body and your memories are transplanted into it, is the new you you, or is it a new you? Are you gone? And I think that's the way they put it. And I mean, I guess I, you know, I'm thinking about soul because that's the way we think about it, or I think about it anyway. And, but I think they did kind of address it. And it seemed like the people who felt like it didn't matter as much, like, okay, there's a new body and there's my memories are implanted in it. That's me now. Those are the people that switched their body because they had a cold. Whereas Jules did not like being refreshed from backup. He said he would do it if something happened to him, but he didn't like doing it. He wouldn't just swap out for nothing, and that's why his body kind of got old. So I think that's how you tell where someone falls in that issue, is, you know, how old does their body look, or how often do they do this?
Well, it almost brings another interesting parallel in. It leaves all the things there, and so I'm going to bring it in, is it you or is it an exact copy of you? I guess in the same way, if I go to Amazon and I buy an MP3, their MP3 that they sold me didn't go away. I just got a copy of it. what would prevent them there for being, you know, 10 of me? You know, if it's just memories and a cloned body, why couldn't I have my memories put into 4 bodies at once and get more done?
Yes. Yeah. I was going to bring this up.
Right. Yeah. I think the point of, you know, of having a society that sort of is done with the soul debate is because they've moved beyond uniqueness, right? I mean, it's apparent in their economy and it's apparent in their metaphysics is that the whole point is that things are not unique. They are repeatable. They are duplicatable. It's your memories, your consciousness, your body. If the soul is simply an accumulation, I mean, it depends on how you define the soul, but if they're talking about a thing that is absolutely unique and unrepeatable, that has no place in the Bitchin society because the Bitchin society, doesn't value things that are unique and unrepeatable.
Well, they value things that are unique the first time you do it, and then they go and repeat it. So, you know, it's unique when you invent it. It just is then repeated ad infinitum.
That's a really good clarification, yeah.
Well, and as they say in the book, they didn't have to convince people that they were right. They just had to outlive them.
Yeah, exactly. Now, my answer for the soul question, and now that I'm listening to you guys talk about the self question, if self is not soul, I have to change my answer because... does your soul die with your original body or does it get moved on to the new one? I think the answer to that is it doesn't matter. Because eventually, you know, you're going to die and your soul goes away. So if it goes away with your first death and then your clones are now soulless individuals, that doesn't make any difference to your soul. And if it gets moved along, okay, fine. Then it just gets to live until you die. So I think it doesn't matter. But if self is something different than your soul, like you guys are talking about, where you could have copies of yourself, which they didn't have in this, and I wanted to bring that up, and I wondered why they didn't, then self, I think, becomes something very different.
I kind of like that. It's kind of like a digital version of reincarnation.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're like say I gotta be in two places at once. Shit. All right. So I make a copy of me. Unless there's some law that says I can't do that, I'm doing that. And unless there's another law that says, well, when you're done with that, we need to merge these memories back together. I don't see how you avoid overpopulation within the first day or so of this.
I just got a vision of a Git repository of my consciousness. That's awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's essentially what they have, right? Because when you restore from backup, they have version control. I mean, Julius's ex, you know, opts for a backup that can, you know, erase several years of her life. And so they do have some sort of consciousness version control.
I just want to be able to use the term go fork yourself.
Does this mean when you want to suggest that somebody live their life differently, you actually submit a pull request to that person?
Well, see, I think the other thing that would be interesting is, are there going to be consciousness version control debates? Well, you know, I want my consciousness stored in Git because I think that does it better. Oh, no, you've got to use Bazaar. No, you've got to use Mercurial. Oh, I'm sticking with the old SVN model.
I can't get it out of my iLife backup.
Can you imagine how snarky the issues threads would be?
If you've got people fighting over text editors now, can you imagine consciousness editors?
Oh my God! Can you imagine the boutique business that would be editing consciousness for people?
Oh, you can do it in Emacs
for sure.
Is that a major mode or a minor mode?
There's already a plugin.
I wrote a Vim script to do that ages ago.
I'll drink to that. Who's thirsty?
I edited mine in Nano. I can't remember anything.
Well, I'm surprised nobody's thought of the natural extrapolation of that is, okay, just forget the whole physical thing, go into a matrix. You know, we have all these people who are bored saying, okay, there hasn't been anything new in 100 years, and I don't expect to see anything new, and so I'm just going to tune out, you know, have myself backed up and have them knock me in the back of the head, and then I guess, like we talked around a little bit, that there is a way that you're stored backup that you can bring yourself up and at least look at the news feed, see if there's anything new, and then decide, well, I'll go back to bed for another 1,000 years. But you know, if you can do that, and you're you you don't want to live in the real world because there's nothing new to see. You know, why not just stay in the virtual world and make whatever world that you want?
Oh, I got.
Why would there be anything? Why would there be anything new there then?
Yeah, I got the impression that there was no virtual world 5150. I don't think our software. I don't think in this book there's a computer powerful enough to run our software at full speed. It was just, you know, it can back it up, it can store the data, but not run the software, I guess, if that makes sense.
If you're post-scarcity anyways, I mean, you should be able to create anything you want in the real world.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's right.
The only difference there would be in a virtual world, the laws of physics need not apply, whereas in the physical world, the laws of physics at whatever point you are need apply. I mean, I know they talk about being in space, and so the laws of physics of space still apply, but you can't just say, well, I don't like this law of physics, so it doesn't exist.
I was going to add a comment, but then I remembered it's a spoiler.
Well, and we haven't talked much about it, you don't have to come back with even a human, a human body, but it could be modified. Julius's old girlfriend modified herself so she could walk naked out in the hard space.
It made me very happy that in the future, when apparently all things are possible, there weren't just a ton of people at Disney World with their assistance dog just crapping up the place.
One of the things that one of the characters said that I thought was an interesting perspective, but I don't necessarily agree with, was he said he didn't want to be a post person, but in a world where I can be backed up, restored to a body that's, you know, 20 years younger, I can have my arms add another two or three sets of arms. If that's not post personhood, I'm not really sure what is.
Well, I think that is what they're referring to, is you can come out with something, you know, different than the original human model.
Yeah, I think by post-person, he meant just software only.
Ah. So one thing I wanted to at least touch on before we get to the drinking and spoilers is, what did everybody think of the reader's voice and performance and such?
I thought he did great.
Sorry.
No, it's same thing. I'd have absolutely no difficulties with the reader.
Yeah, it was kind of unremarkable, so I guess that's good in a way. I didn't really pay attention to the reader. It was just, you know, very adequate for what it was. I thought it was good.
Right. There are some stories where the reader becomes a character in of itself, and you're right. This one just kind of faded in the background, so let the material speak for itself.
Yeah, I think the book we listened to last month, the reader was more actively a part of it because you got all the different personalities were more drastic and the voices were more drastic. Occasionally I had a hard time with some of the more fringe characters because, you know, you can only make your voice do so many things. And it was one person reading all the characters there.
I was going to say, I thought he did an outstanding job considering the job that he had to do. The characters in this book aren't all that dissimilar, and he did a good job at letting you know when each character was speaking. They like, if you read this book just the text of it, I think you'd have a hard time telling them apart if it didn't say Dan said this and Jules said that. They were so similar in what they would say and when, and you kind of needed that little bit of a drawl for Dan just to know. And Dan wasn't very believable as a cowboy. I didn't have to dwell on that. I just marked that up as, okay, well, they're in the future. There isn't going to be many cowboys anyway, so he's the closest thing, and gets full credit for being it, and that's fine. But the first time I listened to this audiobook, it was on Cory Doctorow's podcast, and it was read by Cory. And I thought this guy did a better job than Cory did of keeping these personalities distinct just by the use of his voice.
That was actually one of the other reasons I suggested this version, this book versus Corey's reading of Eastern Standard Tribe was that exactly. This, in addition to enjoying the story more, for the reasons we already talked about, I thought that this the reading was better.
Well, wasn't everything in this book pretty much first person from Julia's perspective? In other words, everything would
Watch out! There's a spoiler there.
No, but everything was, you know, Dan said this, and then he would, you know, the narrator would go into Dan's voice, whereas other books, you'd have to use the voices to track who's talking.
More of a first-person versus a third-person voice.
Right.
And as far as reading and editing quality goes, I'd give this guy an A+. I only noticed one... editing typo. I don't know, what do you call that? It's not I'm not going to say edito, that's ridiculous, but one little editing typo that I noticed in the entirety of the recording. It might have been in the second episode, and it was very small. It's like a single word. So yeah, he gets like an A+ for his recording and his editing.
Okay.
Go for it.
I take it from the commentary in the chat, this is the point where we all go get our beverage.
Yep. We can review a beverage here, and then we can get into spoilers after the beverage review. Who's got a drink with them ready to review?
I'm good to go. It's raining cats and dogs here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, so I decided to pour myself a cup of my favorite tea, which is Mighty Leaf Ginger Twist.
Who makes that?
Mighty Leaf is the brand, yeah.
Okay, and tea with a twist of ginger?
Yeah, it's a really, really heavy ginger herbal tea, and it's fantastic.
Cool. So it doesn't have tea leaves in it. When you say herbal tea, that means there's no tea leaves, right?
That's right. It's a tisane.
A what?
Isn't that the name for an herbal tea? A tisane?
Oh, no, I was asking.
Yeah, it's not. It doesn't actually have any tea leaves in it, so it's a you know, an herbal tea. But I think like the proper name to be specific about it is a tisane, or a tisane is an herbal tea like beverage that doesn't actually have tea leaves in it.
Oh, okay, cool. And you said it's one of your favorites, so obviously you like it.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've been drinking this tea for years. I was doing my master's at the University of Maine in Orono, and I would have this tea when it would get to be about, oh, I don't know, 10, 20, 15 degrees, sometimes below zero. And whenever I want to read books and stay warm, I make a cup of this tea. So when I knew we were having book club and it was pouring out, I knew it was time to make some ginger twist.
Right on.
So that's what, like October to April?
Bing.
I'm about 2 hours south of there, of UMaine.
Oh man, that's fantastic! I'm very envious. I graduated from UMaine.
I graduated
Evan,
from one of the,
and
I
graduated from one of the, what year?
I graduated from one of the branches, one of the branches of UMaine in 08.
Oh wow, man, we must have really we overlapped in our time up in that neck of the woods. What branch of UMaine did you graduate from?
Farmington. So it's way out in the mountains, out near Skowhegan, and now I live down in Wisconsin.
Gotcha. I went to school at UMO with somebody from Skowhegan, and we still keep in touch regularly. And I've been to Skowhegan, and I loved it.
Do you drink your tea with cream or sugar or both or neither?
No way, man. Straight up. But I do steep it extra long. I'll steep a bag of tea for sometimes 10, 12 minutes. I like it strong.
Semiotic steepaholic.
So should I expect a competing episode to my coffee episode about how you make tea?
Sadly, there's nothing scientific about how I make tea. I wish I was a little more scientific about it, but my goal is buy a good electric tea kettle, fire it up, get a good full leaf tea, and experiment with different steeping times till you find one that works, and then drink the same tea for years so you don't ever change anything.
That basically sounds like my coffee episode right there.
Variety is the spice of disaster.
Yeah, man, you said it.
X1101, what'd you get?
I am drinking a gift from a friend. It is Lagunitas Imperial Stout, brewed in Petaluma, up near Jezra's country.
I think I've had that one. That's a good one, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I just had the first sip, and that is delicious.
Yeah, you got my attention when you say stout. What's that one like?
Well, my snarky answer is it's stouty. It's a little smoky, little chocolate maybe, obviously dark enough that I can't see the other side of the glass, which is how it should be. Woo-hoo! Not much head on it. Very good, though. I expected it to be hoppier, being an Imperial Stout, but it's not. Though I've been drinking IPAs for the past week, so my hop sense could be a little overloaded.
Yeah, that'll temper you. Oh, I like a good smoky stout. They're not usually smoky. How was it on, like, the creaminess?
Not overly creamy. It doesn't have that somewhere between creamy and oily texture that you usually get, but this was in a... looking for the size of the bottle. Not seeing it. Well, a large-ish bottle. 1.6 ounces bottle.
Oh, wow, that's huge. Yeah, so the oil could still be at the bottom.
Well, I poured it. I don't drink it out of the bottle. It's too big of a bottle.
Yeah, no, I'm kidding anyway. And what about sweetness? Where does it fall on that spectrum?
Yeah, there's a little sweetness there, but not at all overwhelming. It's nicely balanced.
Oh, man, that sounds fantastic. I'm going to have to look for that one.
I'll snap a picture and send it to you if you want to include it in the show notes.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever included a picture in the show notes. I'll give it a try.
Or if you just want to, you know, have a picture of it, so you can go find it.
You could probably include the Beer Advocate link easier.
It's not a bad idea either. 50, what are you drinking tonight?
Okay, this was something I almost didn't pick up last week because, it's from Fireman's Brew, which is in UKIAH, California, and this is flavor beer from them that I hadn't seen locally yet. They have another couple of them, I think an ale and a lager that I, you know, started seeing locally probably 3 months ago, and tried both of them and was not at all impressed. I didn't really like either one of them. And they're fairly expensive here, but it runs about $8 a six pack. So with the experience that I had with those, I wasn't really eager to grab this off the shelf, but this is their brunette beer. It's a double bock, and it's made with chocolate malts and they say imported hops. They don't say what imported hops. I'm a sucker for a chocolate stout or a chocolate box, something like that. So I did try it. It's okay. It's not great, but you know, I don't really have a whole lot of choices around here right now for a chocolate stout, but my favorite beer that I've ever had is Mackeson, which is a milk stout also made with chocolate malts. And they didn't really import the actual Mackeson from Britain. They set up a brewery here and made it for about 3 years, and I guess it didn't work for them financially, and they quit. So, but that's my favorite beer of all time, and this is sort of an echo of it, but it's a very poor, distant echo. But right now, it's about as close as I could get. So, you know, I'm certain I'll drink this again, but it just could be so much better.
Have you had Young's Double Chocolate?
I have, and that kind of tastes to me like a Yoo-Hoo. So, or is it Yoo-Hoo the chocolate stuff that you shake up?
The almost chocolate milk.
Yeah, I mean that's okay, but that's not what I'm looking for either. I mean it tastes like chocolate and without no beer. You know, this is not really sweet. Mackeson is a sweet beer by comparison. This one isn't so much. It's a little on the sweet side. A little maybe from the hops. Maybe a little spicy or tangy. It's not, you know, no more than you expect from a double bock. Or maybe less than you'd expect from a double bock. It's not very hoppy. I mean, it's more hoppy than an American lager, of course, but it's no more hoppy than you expect from a beer of this type. So, at least I found one, you know, one offering from this brewery that I can tolerate. Like I said, I'll have it again because you know, of that style of beer, I don't think I have anything else I can get around here right now. There's that one milk stout that's popular. I've seen it a few times, but it's just a milk stout, lactose stout without any taste, hint of cocoa in it. So, you know, I don't think it's worth the price that's on it, definitely. But like I said, I don't have much options for this style of beer here locally right now. So I guess I'll give it a thumbs up on that.
Well, two things. First is $8 for a six pack is a good price in my area for a craft beer. A lot of them are a lot more expensive than that. There's quite a few that are $10 and $12 for a four pack, but for a microbrews are usually $8 for a six pack. But what is, I'm not familiar with a double bock. What is a double bock generically?
Oh, you'd think, being on pod brewers for a year, I would be able to answer that, but, it's a type of ale, but, let me do a little, hitting of Wikipedia while someone else tells about their beverage.
All right, Pegwell, you want to go next?
I'm drinking some very cheap coffee. That's all I got.
Word. How do you brew it?
In a French press.
Here you go. That helps. Cream and sugar?
Cream and sugar?
Booyah. Drink it black.
Man's got hair on his chest.
I keep looking for, thinking about doing a French press, because I've done the way I do it for so long, and I keep hearing so many people talk about French press that it really does sound good.
It's different. It's very strong.
But it takes some of the bitterness. Yeah, it takes some of the bitterness out of the coffee.
Sounds exactly like what I want.
You get a lot more of the actual coffee flavor, not just the bitterness. And really, as far as getting into it, you can go to Walmart and get like a Mr. Coffee one for like $20. I mean, it's not going to be like the greatest quality French press, but it's going to last you quite a while. I've had mine for about a year now. I've gone through three of them because I'm clumsy and I often knock them off counters and break them.
I bought a plastic one. Hey, you know what? X1101, there's a discount store near my house, and they had a single cup French press. It looked like it made about 8 ounces and or maybe 10. And I already have a French press. I wasn't going to get it, but I could pick that up for you. You could grab it next time you swing through if you'd like.
Sounds good to me. Let me know how much it is, and I'll hit you back with beers.
It was like $6 or $7. It wasn't even beers. It was like beer.
Hit it with some Woofy.
Right there you go.
Beer Woofy.
And Taj, did you say yet what you're drinking?
I have not. I decided to go crazy tonight. Just throw caution to the wind. And I have a big old tall glass of water. Not any water, but tap water.
Ooh, oh, daring. Did you filter at least?
Nah, nobody got time for that.
Oh, slow down there, man. Slow down there. Aren't you driving?
Yeah.
I'm going to party with that guy.
I knew something had gone to your head. I wasn't sure what it was.
Well or city water?
I think we're on the city line right now. We actually have both. We can switch back and forth, which is kind of nice. But I'm pretty sure we're on the city line right now.
Oh,
go ahead, 50.
Okay, get back to if Tracy Holtz listens to this, he's probably going to drive up here to slap me. I said this was an ale. No, a Bock is a sweet, relatively strong in alcohol, and very lightly hopped lager. A double Bock is just more the same. More higher alcohol content and sweeter. Usually tends for to be rather dark for a lager, so it's no wonder I don't taste a lot of hops. I'm tasting like the bitter dark chocolate flavor, but not really any hops because they're in a Bock. There shouldn't be any hop presence. So okay, I should have known that.
No hops.
Well, not it says Bock should have no detectable hops. Like I said, it's a little. I mean, sweet and a little bitter. Bitter aftertaste at the same time, and that, you know, it tastes like eating, you know, Baker's chocolate essentially.
So it's got hops, but it's not a platform for the hops to stand up on and yell its name at you.
Right, right. I am not traditionally a big fan of hoppy beer. I mean, I always like to try new beers, but you know, there seems to be this tendency these days for, you know, my hops can beat up your hops, and you know, just have hops and nothing else in the beer.
Definitely. And I've said it before. Beer. Every store has 5 to 15 IPAs, and you're lucky if it has a stout.
I had an IPA over the weekend that was from Stone, which everything I've had from them is fantastic, but they used what they were calling hop bursting, where at the end of the brewing process, where there usually isn't hops, they take and chuck a whole bunch more hops in it. So it's basically hops with a finish of more hops.
Oh, that would be a really... That sounds like a not fun aftertaste.
Yo, oh, dog. I loved it. Yo, dog, I heard you like hops.
Yeah, that's kind of how it was.
I think there's a beer that actually says that on the box.
I have to find that.
Okay, so now 50, it sounds like it's like... when they say double, does that mean like double fermentation?
No, it just...
Just extra.
Means more intense. Yeah, just extra. Just more... probably sweeter than the regular Bock, and also higher alcohol content. Though the Wikipedia story says that traditionally a regular Bock can go from 6.3 to 7.2%. This is 8% beer, so this will catch up to you pretty fast.
Yeah, that sounds it. I usually, one of my go-to beers, if they've got it, I usually grab it, is... Long Trail. It's a Vermont brewery. They've got a beer called Double Bag, and it sounds like you're almost describing Double Bag, but I know that's a double fermented. I'm pretty sure it's a double fermented beer, but it's got just enough hops to make it beer. But yeah, it's pretty heavy and malty and not too sweet. You might try looking out for that one.
I see that all the time, but with a pokey stamp of approval like that, I'm gonna try that.
Oh, it's my go-to beer if they have it. If they don't have it, I'll grab Sam Adams, of course. But if they've got that, and I usually grab it if they have it, just because I like it that much. And then if I feel like experimenting, I'll experiment. And if not, then it's Sam Adams. Like, Sam's my number two. But okay, so sorry.
That has to be the thing I absolutely love, having moved up here from the Midwest, is just the plethora of micro and craft breweries. You know, when I told my mother when I went to visit her to get me some IPA, and I expected, you know, Sam Adams, because that's craft brew where I grew up, and I was pleasantly surprised to get something else. Whereas here, you know, a craft brew, as you said, you can spend $10 or $12 and get four beers and not feel ripped off.
Yeah, yeah. I still have to try Yingling. We're still just a little too far north to get that.
Oh, man. Next time I head homeward, I'll get some and stop and drop it off.
Cool. That sounds great.
That sounds great.
I almost cracked one of those tonight instead of the team, and it was a tough call, but Yingling is my go-to.
Nice. Listen, I can't wait much longer. I've got a really special beer here tonight, and I'm dying of heat exhaustion here. I got to try this thing.
Such anticipation.
Sorry, I'm pouring it. Man, this thing's a very aromatic beer. I'm pouring it, and I can smell it from like 2 feet away. It's it's Dogfish Head is the name of the brewery. They're out of Milton, Delaware.
I'm already jealous.
And this one is the Saison du Boeuf, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And I just poured this thing down the very edge of the glass, and it's got like an inch and a half ahead. I didn't even get the whole 12 ounces in my glass, which I usually have no problem doing. This thing built up a head real fast. Tons of bubbles coming up the side. And the guy at the beer store, no, sorry, not the beer store, excuse me, a place called Craft Beer Cellar in Nashua, New Hampshire, he recommended it. I told him I needed one that had a lot of character because I had to review it. And he said, oh, get this. There's all kinds of spices and stuff in it. So the bottle says it's ale that's brewed with parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Oh yeah, and it smells like I don't know, like a what's that tree? Like a cedar. It almost smells like a cedar tree, like the needles, you know.
Man, that sounds great.
Yeah, I was about to say that sounds pretty fantastic and refreshing.
I don't think I had that one, but I'm sure when I went to Philly last year that that one pub that just had like 50-60 beers on the menu had something from Dogfish Head that I tried.
Wow, this is fantastic. He was absolutely right. There's like 6 or 8 flavors in here that are all kind of roll over each other. It's real sweet. It's very sweet. It's light in color. It's pouring out of the bottle. It almost looked clear, but once it's in the glass, it's got quite a bit of yellow to it. It looks like maybe a blonde ale. And the head is just almost pure white. It's it's really good. It's got just all kinds of spices, and it's like almost peppery at the finish. It's something, man. I wish I was one of those super taster guys who could taste a million different things at once. I'm more of like a troglodyte, but I can tell this is special. The guy didn't lie to me. This is a definite thumbs up.
I had something from them over the last weekend that actually had a little bit of wasabi in the finish, and that was really interesting.
Oh, that's cool.
I shared it with a couple of people, and everyone's like, oh yeah, there's the wasabi. And it took me about half my glass before I got it. It was really, really faint on the tail end.
Oh, 50, this is the beer you ought to drink on Colonel Panic nights, because this is, I can tell already, this is real belchy.
Oh, Pickwell's already told me about the beer on the Colonel Panic nights.
Yeah, you kind of have a tendency to just blow right into your microphone. Yeah, this is cool. I wish I knew how to describe this, but it's very complex. I can say that. I can't really put much of a finger on it better than that. Just I'm not good enough as a beer reviewer. But yeah, this is something. I wish I bought more than one now. Like this, that store, if you ever can get to the craft beer cellar, and there appears to be quite a few of them. They're like a chain, but they let you break up all the 6-packs, and you can just make your own 6-pack out of whatever's in the store. Each beer is priced individually, like by the bottle.
Yeah, I've got one of those like 2 miles up the road.
Oh, you lucky duck.
They don't usually have it's not a craft brew store that does that. It's kind of, well, it's called Treats. And it's kind of just a fine consumables. It's got cheese and wine and olives and baked goods. And it just happens to have a little corner in the back with beers and make your own 4 or 6-pack.
I'm guessing they probably sell like bowls and rolling papers and stuff too.
No, it's not that kind of place. Very touristy, that town.
Oh, you're lucky. The only place near me that lets you break up a 6-pack or even has a really good selection, they have half the stores like bowls, you know, it's obnoxious.
Though, give the state a couple of years and maybe we'll legalize, and then maybe they will start selling that stuff.
Yeah, and it's not that I have a problem with it. I don't know. It just seems to be like a big, ridiculous, obnoxious distraction.
Get that its own store and get it out of my beer store.
Yeah, kinda. Did we get everybody?
I think we did.
Okay, cool. Yeah, sorry, we got a full crew tonight, and yeah, boy, the carbonation in this one is pushing it in quick. I can already feel a slight effect from this beer. All right, who wants to spoil this thing?
Well, Pokey, and it's probably something you noticed, since you're talking about the inconsistencies, but in the book, when Julius loses all his wolfy, you know, and you see, you know, he loses the ability to have this apartment, the Magic Kingdom. So he moved from the house he shared with his girlfriend to, you know, a suite in or a room in the modern pavilion or whatever. That's where I stayed when I was a kid. We went to the Magic Kingdom, not kind of like a regular hotel room, but real good views. But then when he loses all his wolf, he can't even get that. You know, it's like, no, you can't stay on the park. They didn't mention what he talked about his college experiences. You know, you can get not even like a cubicle. It's just like a, you know, like one of these Chinese or Japanese hotels where you rent, you know, like a coffin-shaped space that you crawl up into. He loses his ability to have a car. You know, somebody just takes his car. Decides that I'm more important than you are, so I can just take your car that you've been using. But it gets down to the point, I guess he can still eat. He couldn't eat in the park, they won't feed him there. So he's got to, you know, go out to wherever the great unwashed masses eat and eat there. But the one thing that they said that he lost his network access, and maybe that's because he's no longer got it wired into his head.
Yes, that was, I did notice that.
Because, yeah, you know, that's one of the things that the two things they established early in the book was, you know, no matter how much of a bum you are in a drag on society, you get to eat and you get network access.
You know, he even said travel. He said travel and network access. You can even get around.
Well, they will, you know, when he hooks up with the girl who killed him, you know, and they can go into space, you know, so he still has travel.
Oh, no, but he had a pile of Woofy after that.
I was going to say he had buckets of sympathy Woofy at that point.
Right, because that was after the big reveal where it was revealed that he was actually murdered in a scheme to advance Deborah's ad hoc, right?
Yeah.
But yes, that was one of the inconsistencies that I noticed was when his handheld stopped working, I went, wait a minute, that's not supposed to happen. And I didn't catch that until, like I said, the third time I went through this book, that was today, you know, all in one sitting at high speed. And I kind of, you know, I like his word. I flash baked it.
I love that description.
When he was, you know, he was thinking out his options, thinking aloud or, you know, writing it or whatever, he was thinking about going back to space even before Dan publicly told about what he did to him.
Yeah.
Well, I think he went back to space just because he realized he's finally done with Disney World. He's outgrown it. You know, he kept going back there as, you know, hanging on to the past, hanging on to this old thing. But he finally kind of evolved out of it. Lil's parents told him, you know, Magic Kingdom's no good for you, and you're surely no good for it. And he said he realized it as the, you know, at the same time or just before. So he finally realized it's not good for him. It's holding him down, it's holding him back, and he's just destroying it. Even at the end when he, you know, kind of quote unquote wins and gets all that sympathy Woofy and everyone realizes that he was actually murdered. He was right the whole time, sort of. Even that, he tore it all down again. They went back and destroyed all that work again. So he had to get out of there.
Well, yeah, and that's part of it. I mean, I kind of agree with everyone around Julius that, you know, his whole efforts to destroy Deborah's organization by doing these underhanded things were completely non-productive to his own cause.
I think particularly because he was so bad at being subtle.
Yeah, subtlety was not his strong suit. You're absolutely right.
He had the subtlety of a drunken bull in a china shop.
Yeah, I was going to say a hoodie and a crowbar is not subtle.
Well, no, and neither is chasing around the naked girlfriend all over the space station and bumping into everyone who's screwing.
But apparently that's very popular.
Well, in space, you know, everything's popular.
I've already bought my ticket. Cost me like 6 HBR episodes worth of Woofy, but I bought my ticket.
Now that's something we could do. Instigate a deal where you get Woofy when you post an episode and, you know, people listen to it, they can give you Woofy about how good it was.
Well, we already have that. We got the feedback. You know, you can comment on a show if you like it. I try to comment on you know, as many as I can.
Yeah, HPR is already pretty much a meritocracy where, you know, if you put good stuff out, people pretty much appreciate you and tell you about it.
Yeah, it's pretty bitching.
Definitely bitching.
That should go in the new promo.
So here's another inconsistency that I found and didn't notice it. Again, I didn't notice this until the third time, you know, flashback in the book, is why couldn't they make a backup of him? Just because the shit in his head didn't work anymore, that shouldn't affect anything. I mean, originally there were people who got backed up. They didn't have, you can't tell me they had implants before they learned how to back people up. Nobody would volunteer to go under the knife for that experiment.
Because Julius was alive before they did, you know, he was on the tail end of the not bitching society. He was 20 years old before they had the bitching society and had that, you know, were post labor and before they had the tech, you know. So he even talks about it that he did have the implant surgically implanted the first time.
That leads those two ideas lead into the thing that I had seen was kind of exactly what 50 was talking about, where that first generation that was alive during the revolution when the Bitchin' Society took over, they had to have started out as 100% biological and at some point had those cochlear implants implanted. I know that every generation that was born has to start out as, you know, 100% flesh and blood and then have the cochlear implants implanted. And then from there, any clones that they have could have it grown in or whatever. So if his broke, why couldn't they rip it out and put a new one in? Other than the fact that that's a huge plot device and would totally trash the story.
Well, right, because there's that.
There were no... Well, of course, yeah. The doctor said, well, we can't do that. But obviously, they have to do it for adolescence the first time. I mean, this is one of the things we talked about that Wolfie could buy for you. If you had high enough Wolfie, you could actually get real doctors. The doctor in this story was a guy... All he knew to say was, nope, you're sick. We need to restore you from backup.
A technician, not a doctor.
Exactly. The implication was, yeah, it was probably scientifically possible, but he wasn't worth doing, you know, like first heart transplants. If you had to pay for it yourself, you'd have to be Howard Hughes to be able to afford it. And this was, you know, this kind of thing here. You're not important enough for us to spend these resources on keeping your screwed up body alive.
It still doesn't work, though, because he had plenty at the end of the book. And it's not his body that he's trying to keep alive. It's his memories of Dan that he's trying to keep alive. So at the end of the book, he's got loads and loads of Wolfie. If there's someone on the planet who knows how to either implant new technology or extract the memories for his next backup, you'd think he would have done that. And in the context of the story, that there isn't someone who can do that. But there kind of has to be, because there's Lil. Lil's only 20 years old, and she's naturally born. She wasn't cloned, so she had to have had that, the hardware, the wetware, whatever you want to call it, implanted.
Did they ever actually say that, though? Did they ever actually say that she was born and not concocted, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, she's only in reality 20 or so years old.
No, but he's right. You're right. X1101. They said that she was their daughter, but you're right. It didn't say that, you know, anyone went through the birthing process or even copulation. You're right. She could have been a gene spliced clone for all we know.
Well, that's true. You could clone the fertilized egg, I guess, and then, you know, take with all the stuff in there and boom, here you are, your newborn daughter.
Maybe it's just me, and I maybe made this up as part of my headcanon to make it make sense. And Pokey, you probably know because you just read it. Wasn't there some reference to his like physical brain damage, and that's why they couldn't do it? Like in my mind, it was like the biological hooks they needed to plug it in were not there anymore, were not functioning.
See, I got it was completely the other way. It was the circuitry attached to his biology that was broke.
That's what I understood as well. And one thing that really stuck out to me is how people just go, yeah, I'm just going to do crack. It's what I'm going to do today.
But it was decaf crack.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't want to get the jitters.
That's not something everybody does.
Damn right. No, actually, you guys are both right. The doctor did say that it was a malfunction with his brain or with the brain hardware interface from his clone. But I am certain the doctor was wrong. He was taking a guess at it because the hardware failed. The hardware failed. It got fried when he took the hit from that Herf gun. He didn't know he got hit from the Herf gun until a day or so later. And he never admitted that to the doctor or to anybody else. Only him and Dan knew that. I think the doctor made an assumption there because, again, he's just a technician. This hardware's failing. The only way that I can think it failed was during your backup, because that's only, was it 8 weeks after that, that he went to see the doctor for that?
Not even, I don't think.
So that's an interesting point. How come wasn't Dan fried? Because if it bounced off the Faraday cage around the ride, would it have got both of them? So I always wondered. You know, Dan just didn't say, "Okay, you're being a dick," and I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that, but you're being unreasonable and pointed at Julius intentionally.
Well, because I don't think it was that it bounced so much as that it was directional and it was fired from below Julius. So it was fired through him and towards the attraction.
Yes, absolutely. He told Dan to set it to its widest spread so that it would hit it like a cone. It would fire out a cone, and he wanted the widest possible cone, first of all. So, yes, it did hit him because it was below his head. And he said it was highly directional, but he said to you know, make the cone its widest possible. So it hit him. I don't think anything bounced off of the shielding, because I'm pretty sure, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure that's not the way a Faraday cage works. I think it just kind of absorbs it and grounds it out. But that was something that I had the benefit of realizing the second time that I listened to the book. I knew that his head got damaged at some point, so I the second time through listening to this, I paid close attention to the timeline so that I could keep the story straight. But I had the added benefit of forgetting how the book ended. So even the second time I listened to it, I forgot that it was Dan that pulled the trigger. So that was all a surprise to me.
But, you know, this whole point we're going over was a really big sticking point to me. Not so much when I guess it was my third time through it really hit home, because I read it, I listened to it before I recommend it, and then I listened to it again just in the last week or so. And the last time I listened to it, I'm like, wait a minute, there has to be the ability to put this in to people. The only thing I can think is maybe the stuff that was in him was damaged enough that they couldn't take it out to put a new one in, or he just wasn't worth their time, would have been the other one. But that, again, gets shot in the foot at the end when he becomes worth their time.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's the only thing that I thought of, was that it could not be replaced. It could only be implanted that first time. I think I have to go with that, because I couldn't think of another one.
Yeah, I'm going to invent something here, but it's possible that, you know, he's working with an older version of the technology, right? Or a post-adolescent version of the technology. Maybe somebody of Lil's generation, for example, gets the technology implanted at birth, and so it grows with them. But his was put in, you know, as folks have already pointed out, when he was about 20 years old. So his version might be different and obsolete.
He was on his second or third clone at that point, so it would have been only – sounded like it was only like a decade old.
Yeah, he'd just been murdered, you know, 6 months before, you know, or a year, I guess, eventually. I mean, it would have been refreshed the year before when Dan killed him, and you would assume they would do upgrades when they're growing the clone. They're not cloning the hardware. They got to build the hardware like any other electronic device. I don't think they're using nanobots to create it. And even if they were, he would have had the latest hardware.
Yeah, that's very true. And the fact remains that you can be age apparent, whatever. So, and Dan shifts apparent age, you know, in the middle of the, or about a third of the way through the book. So yeah, that shoots that theory.
Now, what about Dan? What did you guys think of him as a character?
Well, up until the end, when you find out that it was his doing that Jules gets murdered, I found him interesting. And at the end, I guess I still found him interesting, and I couldn't decide whether I liked him or didn't like him.
The word I want to use for him, at first I liked him, but the word I want to use for him, I can't right now.
This episode has the explicit tag, so go for it.
He was kind of a dick. At first, you know, he seemed kind of cool and nice, you know, helping Jules out with, you know, getting food and all this other stuff and just whatever, and like sharing his stories and all that. But then, you find out later, you know, he has him killed, but, and he also ends up hooking up with Jules's girlfriend. It's not really that cool. It's kind of a, he's not really, you know, much of a bro there.
Well, there, you know, I think we've all met people like this who have tons of charisma, and you know, they're liked because everybody wants to like the guy, and but they're, you know, they're sort of a user of all the people around them.
Right. And I think that through Dan, we get a little commentary from Corey, like through Dan and through his character development, through his actions, we get a little commentary from Corey about, you know, the plausibility of a society based entirely on reputation. It still does not eliminate selfishness. And Dan turns out to be a really, really selfish character. You find out throughout, you know, especially toward the end.
It also, I think, talks about how volatile, I know I brought this up earlier, but how volatile a reputation-based economy would be. I mean, it could take you 10 years to build a good reputation and one petty thing to blow the whole thing.
The volatility makes that reminds me of something I wanted to say earlier. If it is that volatile, and it seems to be, and it seems like it would be, I can imagine that just based on your location, you have runaway inflation. Like I can see things in some places, very little woofy goes a very long way. And then in other places, like desirable places to be, like the Magic Kingdom, it takes tons of woofy to get anything done at all. Which I just, we can get back to that or skip it or whatever. It's not really that important. What I wanted to ask, do you guys think Dan really was a dick? Was he just a dick? Or did he have a lapse? Did he have like a, because he lost all his woofy and was broke and couldn't get anything done, that he just had a weakness? And would he be okay if he was okay again?
No, I think he was maybe sort of a sociopath. I mean, you know, it's so easy for him to make friends and get people to do what he wants to do because everybody wants to hang out with the cool kid. You know, he can afford to sacrifice friends. He just doesn't really understand. He has no concept.
But that's only when he's popular. You know, he does still kind of need friends to, you know, lift him back up when he's burned out.
I don't know. I see Dan as like completely everything he does is totally justifiable by their economic system. Like if you take like the example of Jules' car, like someone just takes it because they don't think he deserves it anymore. I see Dan as being like, as much as he preached and railed against things, he's like the perfect epitome of how that system works. And Jules is just old enough to remember something different.
I think you're right. And I think the only thing that made Dan a dick is that he's old enough to remember something different. Because even Lil said it. They were like, dude, they only killed you. It's not like they did something permanent.
Right. I mean, it's not like murder is actually a crime. I guess if they could have caught the girl in the beginning, there might have been some consequences, but there's absolutely no mention in the book of anything like a justice system.
However, he did take Lil, and that's a dick move. I realize it seems like the only two things of any scarcity whatsoever are real estate and quality people. And clearly Lil is a quality person, or at least an interesting one, but she bails on Jules so fast that I don't think she's that much a quality person. So I think taking her was a dick move of Dan's.
She bails, but Jules is also practically batshit crazy during the time she bails. So, I mean, there might be a little bit of a reason for her to do that.
Yeah, she's used to people on mood-altering drugs automatically implanted in your brain because the computer in there says, yeah, we need to mellow you out a little bit. I mean, I don't know why people should take crack, would want to be smoking crack. They could just tell their computer to just flood their head with drugs.
Or dopamine, yeah, the result of drugs. No, I saw what Lil did as not being excusable or inexcusable. I just saw it as being immature. I think anybody who'd been around long enough would have known, hey, there's really actually something wrong here, and we have to figure out what it is. Whereas she was just like, well, there's something wrong here, and it's all about me. That's just an immature way to look at things, and I can understand that because she was only 20 compared to his 100 and Dan's 100 and plus. But I don't know. I still don't think that excuses Dan. I don't think that's any indication of her being a you know, spectacularly quality person.
Well, I mean, ultimately, I keep going back to the economy. I think that that's part of that. Like, if you're to get wolfy, like, you do things for other people, which it looks like a good idea, but really you're always doing it for this selfish motivation to make more. So I could see, you know, it a lot of people being all about themselves.
In a society where there's no scarcity and everybody has their needs net, Wow. Okay. So this beard did get to me. Do you think that there is or can be such a thing as altruism?
Well, on one hand, everybody who's maintaining the park is doing it because they care about the park and they care about people's experiences when they come to the park, but they're also doing it to gain the reputation of having done it. So maybe.
I think at first, like, emotion would be the reason why altruism would still work. But I think over time that would wear away. Like, people would just get rid of it. I think the people who are old enough to remember, you know, like, somebody does something for you really nice and it's thoughtful, you know, that would be, you know, they might do it not because of Wolfie, just because. But as people compared that against other things where they got rewarded, I think it would slowly fade away. It's to me, it's the same thing as like the kids in my classroom. Every time you ask them to do something, the first thing that they ask is, well, what do I get? And it's all about that. And I see it just kind of an extension of that going forward.
And I see the people working the park, a lot of it is, you know, doing something just to be doing something, to have something to do, to give give their life meaning. I mean, if you have robots, you know, building your spaceships and doing all that for you, certainly you could have robots running around keeping the park running forever. It's just, I guess, one thing, there's scarcity of something to do to actually give your life meaning. I mean, not everybody can you know, write symphonies or you know, come out with these new mass transit plans.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was Dan's main point into why he ended up, why he was going to kill himself and ended up deadheading, was the scarcity of something interesting.
Yeah. I see, everybody that we see is into creative things, and maybe that's like the one thing that they can't reproduce, you know, creativity or like art in general, because even when they're talking about redoing the mansion and stuff in the Hall of Presidents, like, it's all in a way an artistic pursuit, and the Imagineers, that's an artistic pursuit. Like, that's writing symphonies, that's an artistic pursuit. Like, maybe that's something that they haven't been able to quantify in the Wolfie system, and so that's what people are drawn to do.
I am 100% with you, Taj, on that and on the last thing you said too. I do not think that running the park is an act of altruism. I was going to say, I think running the park is an expression of art. And I don't know where I heard it. I heard it a long time ago, but I've heard that poor people or the lower class, they want their kids to be middle class, and middle class you know, workers, they want their kids to be, you know, technicians and scientists and doctors. And those people, technicians, scientists, and doctors, the upper class, they want their kids to be artists. It always seems to come around to artists. And then artists, I forget what they said artists want their kids to be, but it seems like in this society, yes,
fed.
Artists, say again?
Fed.
They want them to be fed? Yeah, that's true. That's true. And yes, it does seem like everything that people are working towards in here is art. And if all your science is taken care of, that actually makes sense.
Right. That's sort of harkens back to what we were talking about a little bit ago with the pursuit of the unique, right? When everything else can be copied, the perpetual pursuit is that thing. Well, we're constantly in pursuit of that thing that can't be, that is a once occurrence, like that novelty, right? The constant pursuit of novelty, because once it occurs, you know, we have the flash of uniqueness and creativity that then can be, you know, quantified, copied, and relegated to sort of the dustbin in the search of the new again.
Well, and that's exactly what I think the flash baking is the first time, is that it's something clever and new and mind-blowing, and then they want to do it for everything because, hey, this was a cool trick and it worked.
Yeah, yeah. See, then that kind of scares me because I'm not very artistic. I mean, I'm creative, but I'm not artistic. But I can copy like geometric patterns, you know, as far as art, I can do that to like a fractal degree, but I can't make like something creative and unique. I can't imagine things and then make them real from that. It's just not, that's not my talent. So I would be one of the dudes living in the little you know, below ground coffins eating the goop from a dispenser.
Well, I mean, Julius says that at one point, you know, he says that folks who do some of the work, like he says, the dull repetition of labor and he says, you know, tending bar or mopping up toilets, he says those people command a lot of woofy and they, you know, enjoy a ton of leisure time because they accumulate a lot of goodwill for the tasks that they do.
And like you're talking about, like, not being artistic. I think artistic in a broad sense, like past just like physical art or like creative art. I kind of like, I'm going back to like way back to Star Trek. Like that's probably like the biggest example of a post-scarcity society that pretty much everybody's familiar with. If you're not in Starfleet or something like that and you're a human being, because humans are the ones that are post-scarcity. If you're not into science and exploring, you're like a chef or like you run a winery or like, it's, you know, art can take lots of different forms. You could argue that even being an explorer or scientist is a form of art. Like there's something behind that. I mean, obviously in like a Star Trek or even in this world, they probably can send robots to do all the exploring they'd ever need to do. Like it's probably really inefficient to send the humans to do it, but they still do it because there's something there to do. And it's fulfilling in a way.
And at least, you know, in the Star Trek, you know, comparison, there are things that we're human beings, we are still better at than anything we can build.
Right.
Improvisation, that's about it.
Yeah, exactly.
We can put a ton of robots on Mars, but we still want to go there. I mean, if you told me I could go there right now, I'd be like, all right, sign me up. It's just there's something there, you know, it's some drive that I think some people have. And if you have nothing else to do, why wouldn't you follow that?
Well, Taj, there is a place you can sign up, go to Mars.
That will never happen. That Mars One thing, it'll never happen.
How much of your money did you give them?
No, I just, somebody's going to, there's too much prestige that can be won by doing that, that they'll let just some upstart come up and do it. Somebody else will do it first.
That's woofy, Taj.
Right?
Yeah, you guys can have Mars. I'd rather just go to the woods.
It'll be Mark Shuttleworth.
Now, since I asked, I thought Dan, I saw him a little differently. I didn't think he was a dick by nature. I thought he got desperate and made a bad choice that he kind of got stuck in. And then it's kind of like a, you know, like a downward spiral when you make a bad choice and another bad choice presents itself, but it looks good. I think that was, you know, just more weakness with Lil. I think he might have discovered that he was a hypocrite, being that he, you know, once the woofy was gone, he really couldn't live his life, you know, where he would like to go out to these remote places where woofy didn't mean anything. And he, you know, but he kept accumulating all this woofy, so he stayed comfortable. As far as that goes, he reminded me of a buddy of mine who's like the most likable person on earth. And just everywhere I go, everybody likes this guy and I love him. He's like one of my best friends. I kind of pictured him as him, as my buddy. Not that my buddy's ever gone through a thing where he turned into a dick, but just that likable side of him reminded me of him a lot. And I could really see where Jules was coming from, where he really loved Dan, you know, as a friend, not like, you know, boy-girl love or boy-boy love, but just a friend love.
There was no bromance.
Right, exactly. They were just really kindred spirits. They were close, and I think he meant it when he said he did forgive Dan. And I don't think that that's because Jules was so altruistic that he could forgive the act. I think it was because he loved Dan. He could forgive Dan for anything. He couldn't have forgiven anybody else for that.
Well, you do have to take into account, too, that being murdered doesn't mean that much. It was a very minimal inconvenience to him.
It meant a lot to him. He took it very seriously. He took it so seriously that people took note of how seriously he took it.
And in the end, it did cost him. I mean, eventually it's going to cost him, you know, decades of his life that he won't remember when he gets recycled the next time.
But all the things that cost him were because of choices he made. He could have blown it off like no big deal because he made a backup like 15 minutes before. if somebody told you they needed you to do something and it was going to cost you a day of your life and it was a good friend of yours, you would probably laugh it off, do it, and not even – I mean, it's like Dan asked him to help him move. I've helped people move that takes more time than he was inconvenienced.
Okay, so you said that everything bad happened to him because of his choices. I think I can counter that and say that all of his choices were made because he was victimized. If he wasn't feeling like a victim, he would not have made many of his bad choices.
Well, him being murdered put Deborah closer to her goal, which she eventually achieved of, taking over not just the Hall of Presidents, but the Haunted Mansion as well.
Right, and that's exactly what I was going to say, 5150. I think that Julius wasn't so upset about being murdered. It wasn't the actual act that really frustrated him, even though he did not enjoy it. He says several times, I don't enjoy being brought back to life. But it was what it represented, right? It was this moment of betrayal from who he this guy that he really does genuinely love, like his best friend in the whole world. And instead, his best friend betrays him in the most insidious way possible. He's teaming up with his arch rival, Deborah, who Julius obviously disrespects and has no faith in, and who he sees as unimaginative and just sort of, I mean, he respects her skill and her craft, but he doesn't like what she are just going to do to the park. And so I think when we're talking about, how Julius feels towards Dan, it's more the symbolicity of being murdered by his friend. It's why would you do this to me? Because you teamed up with somebody, I don't like, and who's actively trying to undermine me.
And, all these changes towards flashbacking. I mean, that kind of I kind of developed an interest in the rides while I was going through this. I mean, I've been to Disneyland and Disney World, but kind of rekindled that. We might talk about that before we quit. But, the point was made in the book. Why rip out the original ride? If you're just going to do flashback, you can put that on the net and people can experience it anywhere. I guess you could do, and I'm certain they, why they have vids. That's a good question. Maybe the flashback is such a new thing, but why sit down and watch a vid for 3 hours where you could just flashback the story and you could be the star of the vid through the whole thing? It seems like that's, I could see it would be cool. Oh, we'd have a ride and, you can walk in and actually experience your own personal ghost story. This is one of the things we talked about before. You can't really have a ghost story in the real world, but you can flashback it, and you can actually, then remember being chased by ghosts and vampires or whatnot. So, why rip out the ride to do that? Why not just have it floating around on the net?
Real estate. The importance of that was real estate. It was the location of the thing. Jules said it. They could have done that anywhere. They could have done it anywhere else, and it would have been probably just as well received. I just don't think it would have come with the scale of Woofy, that comes with doing it there. And I'm totally on Lil's side with preserving the Rube Goldberg machine, just because it is art. As far as keeping the park the way it is, I like it for its mechanical intricacy. I'm not with Jules for keeping it the way that it is just because it can be consistent. I don't like his idea of it. I think they had very different motives for doing what they did, and I'm on Lil's side and not Jules's in this particular case.
Well, actually, have it enhanced some of the effects at for that ride since they both opened, I think, in 1969 for the one in California, I think it's the next year or later that same year for the one in Florida. Both of them, they've made subtle improvements, but I'd like to get on this before we quit. I know it's getting late, but I went back through and watched some YouTube videos on how the effects, like the ballroom and everything, were actually done. And, it's just really, I mean, they're actually the the visual effects is stuff that dates back to the 1800s that they're doing. And I just thought it was incredible. Hey, they were, you know, they had this whole elaborate thing built in 1969. This is supposed to be 300 years in the future, and it hasn't been altered until then. But Jules himself came up with all these ideas. Oh, we're gonna rip out the tracks. I mean, they talk about ripping the big reflective window out of the place. And I've got a little history on that. So, you know, once you do that, it's no longer the Haunted Mansion as any of us know it anyway. So I'm not so sure I see too much difference between, you know, having your animatronic ghouls run by run by sad people working from their from home. Though I shouldn't say this, but outsourced to the internet, you know, people are going to be running these ghouls around.
Telepresence, they called it.
Right, it's going to be complete. It's going to be a completely different experience after 300-400 years or whatever it's been. Well, I guess it hasn't been that long because Jules is only 100 or so, 200 years, let's say. So he's all for that. You know, this sort of halfway measure that he's come up with. But after things have been preserved as is for 200 years, I think, you know, you change it and you lose all the history.
Yeah, I think Jules was a hypocrite to do all that. And I mean, absolutely, he was a hypocrite. At first, what he was talking about was preserving the place, and so was Lil for, you know, their own reasons, what you just said. But yes, when he did that, when he said we have to change to stay ahead of Deborah, that was just a competition for possession. That was not he became a hypocrite at that point. But I will stand by my earlier statement and say that I think he did that because he was victimized. I don't know that he would have made that same choice if he wasn't feeling. I mean, everyone's been a victim. Everybody knows that feeling of complete powerlessness and weakness and desperation. And I think that's where he was when he made that decision.
Go ahead, Pegwell.
We were talking about things that bugged us a little bit. This kind of just popped in my head. I'm sorry for interrupting this part. But when he was going to be restored from one backup and the doctor says that he's stroke prone, and it actually goes into detail about how he died from a stroke at one point, and he remembered all of that. Why in the backups can they not fix that? That's something that kind of did bug me.
Well, you've got a point. If they can give you extra elbows, why couldn't they fix that?
Oh, I think that's just because it was genetic that he was stroke prone, not software.
Well, they're not giving you extra elbows and software. I mean, they had people walking around with, you know, extra arms, more joints than the rest of us. I think Corey was a little confused. He said, you know, reverse jointed like a bird or something at one point. And really, they have the same joints and legs we do, just at different lengths, you know, or like a cat or something, you know, cat. You know, it only looks like it's backwards because you're looking at what we think of as a knee on, say, a cat or a dog. That's actually their heel, and they're walking on their toes, and they've still got a knee. It's just they have incredibly short thighs, so by comparison.
Yeah, but those things are all surgical.
Yeah, but no, these people are being cloned with, you know, with extra parts we don't have. So why couldn't you fix a congenital heart condition or an aneurysm or something before the next iteration?
I don't think they were being cloned that way. I think he was talking about them being surgically altered. And he even made mention of gene splicers turning out to be complete freaks. And he said he didn't want to turn out like one of them because they were just, apparently that was just not perfected then. Boy, we talked about gene splicing earlier. I didn't think of it then. But yeah, he did say he didn't want to turn out like one of those gene splicing weirdos or freaks or something. I forget the word he used.
Okay, I have to disagree. I think these people were just, you know, they think of something new they want on their body, and they throw away the old one and have themselves cloned with extra parts.
I was under the impression that, as Pokey said, they were added surgically, like, to the existing body. I would hazard a guess that, like, once they died or got tired of that, like, then they could just restore from another backup and just have a regular body again.
Okay, maybe I missed that. If you two say it was, you know, post-cloning modifications, I'll accept that.
I had a question I wanted to bring up, simply because I just kind of want to get everybody else's opinion on it. I didn't touch this book for a very long time because it had to do with Disney. I'm the world's grumpiest man, and I hate everything that has to do with Disney.
I'm with you.
And so I wanted nothing to do with this book. And why did Corey pick that? Like, it's obviously like a distinct reason. I have my theories, but why Disney? Why did he pick that?
Let's hear your theory, because I know the answer.
Oh, you know the answer.
I just want to jump in and agree that I'm also fairly anti-Disney, and for quite a while I avoided this book. Not because I'm grumpy, but because I think Disney has done a lot to harm the copyright landscape, and for that, I really don't like them, and I know that, you know, in the next 10 years, I'm going to have to suck it up and deal with it, because my daughter is going to love Disney everything, and it's going to be terrible.
Disney World sucks. Have you ever been? Like, it's terrible.
Yes.
That's the only reason I don't like it. Like, I don't mind Disney movies. I mean, some of them are cool. I mean,
did Wally you go in the Haunted Mansion, though? Because that was the one thing that I remember liking from Disney World.
It was all right. I'm like a roller coaster dude. So, like, there's like one roller coaster, and the rest of it sucks. I don't know.
See, I figured it was because Jules, you know, he wants to be happy, and, you know, Disney World is supposed to be the happiest place on Earth.
So what was your guess? Because I actually do know the answer, but I want to hear your guess.
Now I'm curious, because you actually know the answer. I don't know. I think it was like, because it you know, in this post-scarcity, post-capitalist world, like, that even then, even after everything else falls down, Disney is somehow like this oasis of happiness. Like, I don't know how that happened. Just kind of, I wonder if it's like just irony or snark that he just picked Disney, or just because it was something that a lot of people know. Like, a lot of people have been there, they have a connection to that place, and some people freaking love that place, and I don't get them at all. Some of those people are in my family, and they're like, oh, I gotta go to Disney like twice a year, and I'm like, what is wrong with you? Like, there's so many better places on the planet to go. I, you know, I've got a bunch of different ideas, but nothing completely solid. So hit me with some knowledge, Pokey. What's the deal?
I have a guess. I want to try to guess before I hear Pokey, because I actually don't know.
I was going to ask if anybody else wanted to pause at a guess.
I would have to say that Corey brings to the novel a love-hate relationship with this thing called Disney, not just the park, but this entity, because he is such a crusader for copyright reform and for the rights of creators. And Disney, as we've already said, you know, as we've already said, has not been the friendliest entity with regard to those issues. But Corey also, I think, personally, is enthralled by Disney Imagineering. I mean, the ability to, they are science fiction practitioners. I mean, what they do is they create robots and they help us imagine the future. And Corey's a science fiction novel, and he's invested in helping people imagine better and different futures. And that's what Disney Imagineering does. And that's what the parks do in the flesh. So, like, I feel like embodied in Corey is this conflicted person who has this love-hate relationship with this thing called Disney. And I think that relationship that kind of relationship fuels a first novel, right? I mean, that kind of intense emotional connection to a place is what you're supposed to do for your first novel, right? You write what you know, you write what you're passionate about. And I would guess, if I had to guess, that that's why I picked Disney World.
Holy shit. That was a guess.
That would be my guess.
You nailed it.
Is that right? Well, then there's no way I could have guessed it that accurately. I must have read it somewhere. Then I must have read it, because I can't. I'm never that spot on with anything.
No, maybe because you're exactly right. He loves Disney World. He loves the Disney parks. He goes on at great. I've heard him go on at great length about the attention to detail paid to every little thing in the park. Like, if you wanted to go through and nitpick the park, you'd be hard pressed to find a piece of gum stuck where that someone stuck somewhere, like under a bench or something, that somebody didn't notice and scrape free, is the way he describes that attention to detail. Every little, you know, screw is painted and covered up, every little repair, everything is just, it's perfect as an experience. And the artistry that goes on, the Imagineering, exactly as you said, and also exactly as you said, and Walt Disney being, you know, this guy pushing these Imagineers and pushing these people to not just entertain, but to give people an experience. He's gone on and on and on about that. But then there is that dichotomy. There is the damage that they've done to the copyrights, intellectual property, as a topic. I don't know if he said this or if I've just thought this so long, but I think Disney has done tremendous, tremendous damage to our culture. Just in the fact that, you know, here's this giant umbrella corporation that, you know, gives out glowing rays of happiness, yet they own, you know, corporations that own corporations that own corporations. And you dig down deep enough and under the Disney umbrella, you've got, I mean, you name it, it's covered under the Disney umbrella. It's just a happy face that they paint on everything. And they do a fantastic job of that in the park. And I'm with everybody who said all their rides suck. And the only really fun ones were the, you know, Space Mountain. And I did like the Haunted Mansion. If this were not about the Haunted Mansion, I would not have been able to relate with the attraction to Disney at all. When I was a kid, we went there and just waited all day in line to get to, you know, three rides. And then when they had the what Corey calls the Snow Crash Parade, it's exactly what happened to us. We said, to hell with this parade. Let's go check out something that doesn't have a line. And we went on the Haunted Mansion 6 times in a row, and it just trapped my attention every single time, trying to figure out how the ghosts in the mirror work, or the shadows in the ballroom that don't have anything casting a shadow. It was stunning to me as a kid, and I could totally relate to that.
I just wanted to throw a few more things into the dichotomy of Disney discussion. Disney has gotten to the point where they own everything. You know, all the things that were cool from my childhood, Marvel Comics, Star Wars, Disney owns that now.
Hear, hear.
Amen.
I mean, to tangent just a moment, I'm really hesitant about what's going to happen with the new Star Wars trilogy. You know, I've wanted it forever, but because it's Disney that's doing it, it kind of hurts my heart a little bit.
I'm not worried about Disney. I'm worried about J.J. Abrams.
I second that. I mean, he's already ruined Star Trek.
Oh, I can't agree with you on that, but I think
you're wrong.
I think that regardless of how you feel about his previous work, I think that him doing Star Wars and Star Trek, just that's one of those where you shouldn't cross the streams.
Well, his whole way of making Star Trek was, I'm going to make Star Trek into Star Wars and throw out everything that was Star Trek. And then he gets Star Wars and he's like, oh yeah, all that stuff that everybody read and loved for, like, you know, the 20 years there was no Star Wars. Yeah, I'm throwing that out too.
No, that was Disney that did that, as far as I know anyway.
I bet he had something to do with it, because that was his whole idea with rebooting Star Trek, is he didn't want to deal with the canon because he didn't know it and he didn't care.
And that is the thing for me, is that there's so much Star Wars fanfic or extended universe canon that's being retconned. That's awful.
Well, I mean, it, you know, and it's ironic because, you know, no other fantasy universe has paid more attention to canon through the years than Star Wars. I mean, right after the first movie, there was some you know, youth fiction, I guess you would say. They because they sure were written for adults. They weren't written for little kids. But about 3 Star Wars paperbacks that came out dealing with Han Solo and Chewbacca before, you know, the events of of A New Hope. And in it, you know, Han climbs into a Z-95 Starfighter.
Headhunters,
yes. And 20 years later, that shows up in the game. So either Lucas, someplace in his original notes, had to talk about the headhunter, or somebody read through those old novels and brought that in.
And see, I thought that Shadows of the Empire, which falls right after Empire Strikes Back, I thought that was the first officially licensed book, and it was written in the 90s.
No, there was, well, everything, like, the way that it had worked with Star Wars is that there were different levels of canon, and they were all, like, it was one canon, but some things were, like, loose canon, so there were a couple books that were before, like, Shadows and the Thrawn trilogy and stuff that were, they still counted, so they kind of cherry-picked. They picked the things that they liked and kind of retconned the other stuff away, So they've always had kind of a flexible continuity, but they at least paid attention to it. I mean, there was literally a dude at Lucas that, like, that was his job. He was like the librarian. He took care of it.
The other point I wanted to make before we wrap up was just the damage they've done to the culture, our culture, because of the damage they've done to the commons. You know, 100 years ago, things that were copyrighted fell into, and I use that term kind of loosely, fell into, public domain. And now to protect Mickey Mouse and to keep Mickey Mouse out of public domain, they just keep pushing copyright forward and basically robbing the commons, whereas Corey is deliberately, intentionally putting brand new things into the commons. And that's, you know, an interesting dichotomy.
X1101, I didn't mean to throw you off, or the text chat that we're throwing back and forth. When I asked if we could wrap, I meant for people to make points, not to say, hey, can I make my point before we wrap? I meant, does anybody have any closing points?
Well, I hate to, like I said, I'll do it quick. Reading this book did kind of bring back the Haunted Mansion for me, because I mentioned earlier when I was a little kid, probably 5 or 6, went out to California and I saw Disneyland, and the Haunted Mansion was closed then. And then we went to Disney World a couple years later, 3 years later. And I think it would have been 72. And I was thinking, I have no recollection of going through the Haunted Mansion. I know it wasn't closed. Why didn't I go through it? And so, yeah, I started looking at the video, you know, the virtual tours online. Actually, I got to all 5 of the different versions, and I mentioned that in the. I won't go over it again. I mentioned in the post to the newsletter, but I was thinking, I don't remember any. I must have missed it. But then, for some reason, taking the virtual tours, soon as I got to the elongating room, I remember, oh yeah, I've been there. So I knew I'd been through it before. I didn't really remember a whole lot about the rest of the ride, but it was nice. You know, I went through a bunch of the virtual tours of the ride, and then there's a great, I did post it. You might include Pokey if you want the links that I put on the submission to the HPR mailing list yesterday. There, you know, it's really an excellent documentary on how they went about building the Haunted Mansion, and the original one and the one Disney World, and how all the effects were created. And then there's another one that I haven't watched that, it is like with about the same people, I think, a behind-the-scenes look at the Haunted Mansion. I think both of them are well worth watching, because a lot of the effects are that, you know, when you're going through that, you know, the ballroom sequence, it's because, you know, everything is done. There's a big clear pane of glass between you and everything in the scene. What it is underneath where your car is going. That's how they do the ghosts. The ghosts are all under there, and they're solid and moving around. But they're varying the intensity of light behind them to make them appear and disappear reflected off this glass. And the reason I wanted to mention that, this glass is a very, you know, when it was made for the original Haunted Mansion in California, it was the biggest sheet of glass ever made, and the mansion was built around it. And so I guess back in the 80s, some yahoo got in there with a pistol and actually shot holes through the glass.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and they were like, what do we do? It's like, we got to, you know, to replace this piece of glass, we've got to tear the roof off the place. And so I guess what they eventually did is they put these, like, spider web decals over the bullet holes. Fortunately, you know, it just blew a hole through the glass. It didn't crack it or anything like that. So the bullet holes are still there.
That, wow, that's almost worth the trip just to go see that.
So I thought that was very, I knew that when I got to the point in the story where, you know, for Jules' thing, they were breaking up that piece of glass and taking it out in sections, you know. So that's like the end of the original experience when you take that glass out.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It's astonishing that the glass stood up and didn't break. All right.
I think it's a pretty thick chunk of glass.
Yeah, still, it's brittle. All right, does anybody else have anything to say to wrap up, or should we start having a public discussion of our private chat about our next book?
I think we know what the next book's gonna be.
Yeah, last three chapters were posted this weekend, so I think he may have been, since you had him on the mailing list, Pokey, I half suspect he may have been in anticipation of us making a choice now.
You might be right about that. Semiotic Robotic, was that your guess too?
About what? Say again?
Were you talking about Street Candles too?
Oh no, that's interesting. No, I didn't put that connection together, but it seemed like everybody was coalescing around Cthulhu.
Oh, I thought everybody was saying put Cthulhu off and do it for October.
That would be awesome to do around Halloween, just because that's such an amazing story.
I can wait until then. I've never heard it or read it.
Hey, Pokey.
Yes, sir.
We're going to do, because you were talking about possibly, because next month is a little short. If we did Street Candles, why don't we do that as August and September and break it in half like we had talked about before, and then do Cthulhu for October?
Well, maybe, yeah. But I don't know. The more I think about it, the less I want to break Street Candles in half. I really think we should just do, I mean, we did. We're almost at 3 hours tonight, you know, not counting the little bit that I recorded before we got here. Yeah, we're like 2.5 hours. So for something like Street Candles, and this was a short story. So for something like Street Candles, I think we just ought to plan on it being a very long show. But my only concern about it being, you know, we pushed this show back a week. So it makes the time period between now and the next recording very short, if any of the home audience, you know, our participants at home, players along at home, whatever you call it. I can't think of the funny word for that. But, you know, if anybody at home wants to listen to it, that might not be enough time for someone who hasn't listened to it yet. And I think we're all almost cheating because I think most of us have heard Street Candles and love it and can't wait to do it. But
I have not, so it'll be a first time through for me.
Nor okay. Have I.
Same
here.
Oh, really? Okay, geez, okay. Because I was thinking, just for that reason and that reason alone, because it's a long book, it's a short month, and it really deserves the attention. I was thinking of saying do that next month and do something shorter this month. And Semiotic Robotic had an idea for a short one, and I had an idea for a short one if we wanted to go that way. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm definitely not in charge of the book club. This is a community project. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, if it's a long book that deserves a lot of attention, and we think that we would benefit as a community from pushing it off a month, I wouldn't mind doing a short one now and then doing it in August. That also, if we pre-decide that we're going to do that in August, for the August to September month, we can allow people more time to read, to listen to it if they choose to.
I agree. That sounds like a good idea.
Oh, yeah. Like assign it now. Oh, that's actually a very good idea. I didn't even consider that.
Yeah, definitely put the link in the notes for this one. But yeah, I can see how, you know, I don't want participants to have to just rush through it to get it done, because it's not something that should be rushed through. It should be savored.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay, cool. That sounds good. And then I don't know, after that or the month after that, we'll do Call of Cthulhu. Oh, shit, I shouldn't have probably pre-announced it. Sorry.
I think you can already spoil that.
Now I'm the dick. All right. So
just beep out everything. Just beep out every reference to Call of Cthulhu. Just, you know.
I can't. 2.5 hours of editing. I'm just going to clip the tail and the head off of it and put the music on and be done with it. Just the way Ken likes it. So what was the one you were thinking of, semiotic robotic, for the short one, since you're our newest host and we've traditionally, you know, let the newest host pick, though I actually that's kind of cutting ties because I don't think he picked one yet. But anyway, what was your idea for a short one?
That's very kind, but I was in the chat, I was responding to somebody else, so I didn't have a solid idea for a short one. I mean, I could certainly come up with some good suggestions and email them to you, but you know, I'll save my new guy card for the future.
All right, and Todd, you haven't picked one yet, right?
No, I was the one that mentioned the short one. I think he was responding to me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, all right. So what was your idea for a short one then?
It is a book that I found like last year, and it hit every like geeky bone in my body, and I loved it, and it's really short, and it's just like a dime store novel, but it's amazing. It's Seth Kinlan, and it's Revolution Radio.
Oh, sweet. Has he got an audiobook of that?
There is an audiobook of it. You do have to go to his site, though, and I'm not sure exactly. Let me look up and see what the site is.
Bitchin', we'll do that for sure. We love Seth around here.
Yeah, I wish I knew that guy personally.
Don't that, we all?
Well, that even be... I thought I had a good idea for a short one, but that tops it. I was going to say we do Cory Doctorow's other book that I just re-found, True Names, because that takes the whole... you know, diff and merge your personality and everyone's in an AI, that takes that idea to its, you know, to Corey's vision of its ultimate end. And I thought that was really good. But, you know, maybe that's like, that's extracurricular. If you finish, would you say Revolution Radio was the name of it? If you finish that before next month, go ahead and listen to True Names just because it's good.
Yeah, it's called Revolution Radio. If you go to Seth.kinlan.com, so it's SETH.KENLON.com, and it's under Stuff You Can Only Hear. He's got a lot of different sub things, but it's under there, and you can get he's got the ebook or the audiobook.
I like
it. What a fantastic idea.
Yeah, it's I picked it up right about the same time I got into ham radio, and the common threads between those two things are unbelievable.
Oh, really cool. All right, so anybody following along at home, the book that we'll review next, and we'll meet for the recording August, what is it, 12th. So on August 12th, 7 p.m. Eastern time, we'll review Seth Kinlan's Revolution Radio. And when you finish that, because it's a short one, start listening immediately to Street Candles. No, start reading. No, put True Names off. We don't have to review that one. We covered most of that here tonight anyway. No, start in on Street Candles, because that'll be a long one. We'll do that in mid September, second Tuesday in September. Awesome plan, guys. Thank you.
And I will have to say, I'll be reading more Cory Doctorow now. This is the first one of his I'd ever done. And when I tried it a year ago, like I said, I decided immediately I didn't like it. So I'm glad you guys made me read it. So it opens up a whole bunch of new material for me to listen to.
Yeah, 50, you have to read Little Brother and Homeland. Like, those are awesome.
I was actually going to suggest Makers.
Oh, that's good, too. Yeah, that one, too.
Yeah.
I was going to say Crap Hound, if you have to have some more Cory Doctorow.
Just going to say, it's all there.
Yeah, it's all there. Do it all. The one thing from my daughter just read Little Brother, and there's something in there that the computer recognizes people by the way they walk, and they call it gait recognition. And, you know, if I go to, like, if I'm sitting with my daughter and there's, like, junior high school kids around especially, you can just point and go gait recognition, because they all do have a unique walk, and it makes perfect sense, and we just laugh at that every time.
Hey, Pokey, if she's more of a fan of physical books and you're interested, I have Homeland here I can loan you guys.
Oh, we already bought it. She already read it on the Kindle. But thank you. Okay, here's an interesting catch. I was going to ask about this, but I just verified for sure. Revolution Radio is going to be exclusive to the Gnudists. This is available in Ogg Vorbis only as a download or as an AAC. What? An AAC? That's kind of weird. Okay, so the Gnudists and the Anti-Gnudists only.
The super free and the super not free.
Yeah, there's no MP3 version of it.
I'm good. I listen to everything on my Android phone, which does play Ogg.
Yeah, I'm good too. And if it's that short, and if you get a whole month, you can listen to it on even a Windows machine can play OGS, so you're okay.
Just download the VLC, you'll be able to use it.
I was going to say exactly the same thing.
All right, so yeah, I think that about wraps it up. This has been one of the most fun shows that we've ever done. This the conversation was really, I don't think we've had this interesting a discussion about a book since we did, now I can't remember the name of the book, the Lester Del Rey book that we did. Might have even been the first one we ever did. But yeah, this has been great, guys. Thank you so much.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks, guys. Really, really fun.
I concur.
Thanks for being the guy that organizes it, Pokey.
Oh, thanks, man. That's sweet of you. You're welcome. You're very welcome. As long as people keep showing up, we'll do this.
All my woofy, Pokey.
Woohoo! Oh, it's too heavy to carry. I need a wheelbarrow.
Use some of that woofy. Buy a wheelbarrow.
Yeah, I figured I should finally come on. I mean, you've been inviting me forever, so.
Yeah, we need you around too, man. I love you.
I love you too, man.
Aw. And you too, 50. I'm glad you came on tonight. You had some very interesting things to say. And I love having everybody on here. It's great having so many different perspectives. And it's weird that this book, on the surface, the first time I listened to it, I thought it was a really like lightweight story. But then we get to talk about it. There was so much there to uncover. And that was really fantastic. I don't think I would have noticed that had it not been our assigned book. So, all my woofy to X1101 for picking the book.
I've just enjoyed, you know, having a chance to listen to it a couple of times and getting really a bunch of different perspectives on it because, you know, I've only had one set of experiences and having other filters to process this book through has been really fascinating.
Cool. All right. Well, that's all I have to say. So I just want to thank you guys and say goodnight. And if anybody else has a closing, go for it because I'm all done. I've taken all my time.
Night, folks.
Good night, all.
Peace, everybody.
Bye, y'all.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio.
You don't like Pizza King?
I've never seen one.
No, Pizza King is terrible. It's,
How does it compare to Little Caesars?
It's quite a step up from Little Caesars.
Do they give you a little paper crown to wear while you eat?
No, Pokey, that's Burger King.
Now, Pegwell, do you have the ones that have the train that bring the drinks to you? Because that's like the only selling feature here for my daughter is like, oh, the place with the train.
It doesn't bring drinks to anymore. They got rid of that here. But there is a giant like train car you can actually sit in that's inside the restaurant.
There's a restaurant at the top of the hill here that since I've lived in this town since like 2008, it's had like four different owners and it's never really changed much in quality. It's just kind of bland, but they have a train there now for the little kids to ride out in like their yard. So I want to go back again. And that's the only reason why.
So you can ride it?
So my nephew can ride it with me.
Train's much too big for Pokey. I mean, he needs those little teeny tiny bikes.
I don't need no stinking train. I got my short bus.
Pokey, that fabric you sent me is awesome. I've been playing around with it.
Isn't that nice stuff?
Yeah, it's perfect. When you told me it was floral, I expected something different, man. It's pretty much camo.
Yeah, isn't it? It's like, I mean, it's got flowers on it, but yeah, it's camo. Totally.
To be fair, floral is camo if you're in a flower shop.
Fair point.
Floral's camo if you're in the woods, actually. It's pretty good. As long as it's got plenty of greens and browns in it, or reds, it's fine.
Well, and if it's too, you know, too many of the same colors, even if it's camo, it makes a pattern and you can see it. So, I mean, a little bit of color is not that bad on it.
Right, right, right. Hey, we got Semiotic Robotic. What's up, man? You need a sound check, I bet.
Hey, guys. Yeah, hopefully you can hear me. This is my maiden mumble, and I've never mumbled before, but I hope you can hear me.
Yeah, you sound fantastic.
Sweet. Awesome.
I figure we'll give it a couple more minutes just to see if anybody else shows up, because I know a couple of people, I don't even pay attention to who says, like, maybe and no. I figure if everybody just says maybe to the invite, that means they want to keep it on their calendar, and I'm fine with that, but I don't, like, pay attention to
it. Good call, inviting Corey. I didn't know if he would respond or not, but that was suave. Good move.
Yeah, he only emailed me, so I didn't get, like, his voice, but the tone of his email, he seemed disappointed that he couldn't make it. And he's just the combination of time zones and how much he's traveling right now and how little sleep he's getting, this would keep him up well past midnight. So I think it would even start well past midnight. So he couldn't spend the sleep on it is, you know, what I got out of it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I probably would have made some kind of Eastern Standard Tribe joke about that.
Oh, I definitely should have, but I did get a little something out of him. I was looking for his short story, one of his short stories that I like a whole lot, and I could not remember the name of it. And his website is really not good for searching stuff on, but he told me what the name of it was, so I scored there.
What story was
it? It's one called True Names, and he wrote it with somebody else, but it's fantastic.
That was really a head trip. I remember reading that one.
I haven't read that. Did he write that with Charlie Strauss?
I'd have to look that up and see who he wrote it with.
You guys heard me okay?
Yeah.
Loud and clear, man.
Okay, it's weird. Ever since I updated this computer, the fancy headphones and speaker or microphones haven't wanted to cooperate. I've been breaking up like I had no bandwidth. So I wanted to ask you in time to go switch to the other computer.
There is something weird going on with it. You do sound a little echoey, but it's a really short echo. It's not, it's more like a weird sound than an echo. It's not like distracting or anything, and it was a bit of static too, but it's not bad. It's certainly doable.
Okay. Yeah, on my end it sounds like a little static around your voice.
Yeah, I'm only getting static.
You can't hear me, Pegwall?
No, man, I mean, I can hear you, but I mean, I'm only getting that little bit of static there. I'm not hearing an echo.
Oh, okay.
And Semiotic Robotic, are you using headphones or speakers?
I'm using a speaker. I'm actually on my mobile phone.
Okay, all right. You've got. Oh, really? That's Plumble?
I'm on Plumble.
Wow, that's the best I've heard Plumble sound. You must have a Wi-Fi connection.
Even on Wi-Fi, mine sounded awful.
Yeah, I'm on Wi-Fi.
What device are you using?
It's a Galaxy Note 2.
I've never heard one sound that good.
Yeah, I had a 2012 Nexus 7, and I might have just had some settings wrong, but I sounded bad.
Well, Plumble just updated today in the F-Droid repos, too.
Yeah, I was thinking to myself, boy, what great timing. I don't even know if I got the update, though. I guess my phone automatically installed it, but yeah, it was great timing.
Yeah, it sounds good, too.
Great.
When I saw Corey on the invite, I had two conflicting thoughts. My first was it would be really cool to talk to him, and my second was a very strong concern that I would just go all fanboy and it would be weird.
Yeah, I had that worry myself.
I kind of had the opposite worry because I didn't particularly like this book, but I really like his other stuff, so I didn't want to like offend him.
Well, I've read several of his books, and I haven't found one I didn't at least appreciate, even if it wasn't exactly what I liked.
Oh boy, I can't wait to begin the review.
This is going to be good.
Benjamin Rosenbaum was the guy that he wrote True Names with.
Interesting. I definitely didn't know he collaborated with anybody other than Charlie Strauss, so that's really interesting. I'll have to look it up. Obviously, it's CC licensed somewhere.
Oh yeah, you can get it on his website in any format you want, and I think I downloaded it. The audio version from his website too, but I listened to it on his podcast a long time ago, maybe 2-3 years ago, and then when I got back with him, he told me the name of it. I downloaded an ebook and just was reading it on the Kindle.
Cool.
It's a very good read. I'm enjoying the read even more than the audio book, which is strange for me.
Yeah, I'll admit up front, I cheated a little bit on the old audio book club here and actually reread Down and Out because it was easier to do on the bus and before bed.
Interesting. All right, we should start this thing then. You guys all ready to start? Any objections?
You have the recorder on?
Yes. You asked me that last time and it made it into the post show.
Well, I figure it's funny enough, I should point it out so that doesn't happen again.
We should just pretend like we this is like the third take. We should just pretend like that.
Take four.
Just make it a running gag.